Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Super Podcasts. I am the terrible Australian Bede. I hope you're all doing really well today, and I hope you had a great Christmas and New Year as well. And with me, as always, is the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Sorry, that just came out. I didn't mean to offend everybody with bad accents.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Yeah, all right. I totally wanted to.
Marcy, you realise now on this show we have to offend as many people of many countries as possible.
Yeah,
you
know I think I'm going to offend everybody.
Actually, that's my job to offend people.
You are the terrible Australian.
Of course.
So should I ask you why you were a terrible Australian for the first show of the new year?
No, I'm only kidding. Yes, you can ask me that question.
Okay, Bede, why are you a terrible Australian?
Okay, I'm a terrible Australian because I have seen New York Minute starring the Olsen twins. Actually, that wasn't going to do these things to yourself because
That's
I'm
bad.
Totally evil bad.
There's something wrong with you, dude.
You're only hurting yourself.
Yes, I'm like, but I like it, man. It makes me feel alive. I won't go into
right.
that.
I'm a sinning masochist.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Anyways, after that terrible incident we just occurred, our guest for tonight, first up, of course, is a man who I like to call my arch nemesis. I don't know why, I just like to, because, you know, he just is. and that is, of course, AJ. How are you, AJ?
I'm all right. I'm AJ, and I saw New York Minute in the theater in 2000 motherfucking 4.
Ew!
Wow.
Suck it. I'm the awful American, bitch.
Well,
no complaints,
okay.
though.
Well, I saw it at home, so you definitely win out in this one. So, yes.
What do I win? Nothing.
We'll give you a medal that says awful American.
You win.
The sympathy of everyone here. I don't know.
Well, you win my sympathy because, you know, we're terrible together.
We have no soul, bead.
Well, that's true. Anyways, our second guest for tonight is somebody who doesn't watch bad movies because he has to. Oh, well, depending, of course, on the situation. I'm sorry, I'm really pissing myself laughing.
You just
at the
keep moment. Laughing and it makes me laugh.
Sorry. I'm stuffing up already and it's the first show of the year.
Yeah.
So, anyways, and it is our. Of course, is Sam. Sam, how are you?
Hi, Bede. I'm fine, thank you. How about yourself?
Oh, not too bad. I was trying to do a really good introduction, but then I stuffed it up. I was going to mention your awesome website, 24 frames per second, which is really cool.
Thank you.
So if you haven't seen Sam's blog, go check it now or, you know, he will be very upset.
I will, yes.
Yes, he says so.
Right.
Okay,
I haven't seen New York Minute, which makes me, I think, the fortunate one.
I've seen
Marcy.
Bits of it, so I didn't watch the entire thing. So I did see a little.
Sam's got dignity, or whatever hell that is.
What's that?
Not much of it, given some of the stuff I have actually seen.
Alrighty, before we go on to the topic at hand, I would ask Marcy a question.
Yes,
Marcy. Why are you a terrible Australian this week?
I willingly sat through Mirrors, which made me want to pull my hair out by the end of the movie.
Sorry.
Yes, I agree.
Has anyone seen the original Korean version, Into the Mirror?
No.
I have. It was better.
You know, they sold it here because they just released Mirrors 2 straight to DVD. And on, like, certain copies, they included the original movie. They included Into the Mirror, but not on the rental exclusive copies, which have been the only ones I've been able to find. So apparently the only way to see into the mirror in the U.S. is to buy Mirrors 2.
Well, supposedly Mirrors 2 is slightly better than Mirrors. But having that would be Mirrors hard to 2, do.
I can agree to that assessment. Even though it's still not a good movie.
Yeah, I don't know what went wrong. There was a good idea in there somewhere, but it was, I don't know, it was like an hour too long.
Alexander Aya's career really has been something of an exercise in disappointment, hasn't it?
Mm. So, not a good movie, and you'll find my sort of a review about it on the Arrow website with my dissecting the director piece for next week. That's if it gets published, which I'm sure it will.
Nice plugging.
Yes.
Anyways, moving on.
Speaking of awfulness,
Yes, of course.
That'll segue into our first segment.
Yes. This episode is like our rundown of the films of 2010. So we're going to start off by talking about, very quickly, because I know we don't want to actually sit around and talk for these too long, because who would want to? We're going to be talking about our top three worst films of 2010, and then after that, we're going to be doing our top five best films of 2010, as well as our honourable mentions, so which will be exciting. But before that, we have to scare ourselves shitless with our top three films, the top three worst films of 2010.
Yeah. So who's going first?
Yes, and the started off.
And I'm distracted.
Since you know, she's written an article about an awful movie. I will pick Marcy to start off her picks as the worst movies of 2010.
Sorry, I'm completely picking on you just because it's funny. All right.
Of course.
This is easy. The top worst of the worst for the year. I'm just only naming three. I had a few more really bad ones, but the worst ones were A Nightmare on Elm Street remake, The Twilight Saga Eclipse, and Legion as the fucking worst movie of like the last few years. And I think I've spoken enough shit about all three of those movies.
Legion is definitely, for me personally, the better of the three, but you know.
You suck, Bede. That movie, all that movie is worth is for me to take a shit on it. That's it.
Oh.
Seriously.
I didn't see Legion, but no, I've got to say, Eclipse didn't even make my bottom 10 this year. I mean, I thought it was the worst of the Twilight films.
I fucking hated that movie so much.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it is in no way good.
No.
And no good can come of its existence. But it's not actually one of the 10 worst films of the year.
Yeah, that's the thing. I hate that I can't summon enough hatred for Twilight. I'm just so complacent. I can't throw a shit fit about these movies because they're just dull, not horrible.
Well, I mean, I threw a shit fit about New Moon because, I mean, New Moon was fucking appalling. That's the worst thing, by a country mile. At least Twilight Eclipse has one good shot. It is in the trailer. And it has maybe one intentional joke as well, which, you know, those two things elevate it beyond either of the other two movies.
Kind of somewhat have to agree, although I have to admit, I think of the three, the first film, Twilight, for me is the absolute worst. But that's only because, like, I had no expectations. I didn't know what I was getting into. But after the first one, I was like, blah, fuck this movie. And the other two, I thought were slightly better, but, but that's not saying much at all.
I think the nadir of the franchise for me is the moping montage in New Moon.
To me, the two best moments for me in New Moon were like Michael Sheen, because, you know, he makes everything awesome. He was like the only good thing about that. Oh, well. We're not going to start that up because Marcy will get really angry.
Yeah.
But he was like the only good thing about New Moon because he knew what type of movie he was in. And also that hilarious frolic in the woods, which cracks me up to this day.
Anyway, enough about shitty Twilight crap. Does Bede want to pick somebody else to go next?
Yep, I'll pick Sam. Sam, what are your three worst movies of the year, of last year?
In ascending order, I guess. Number three, Death at a Funeral. Neil LaBute, it would have been more dignified if he'd just given an executive a hand job. And it's a horrible remake of a movie that was already horrible. I think it's best summed up by the fact that in one allegedly funny sequence, Tracy Morgan shits in Danny Glover's hand. I think that's a metaphor for the entire film.
Right.
Number two, The Bounty Hunter.
Bede loves that movie.
I don't.
Sorry?
I said Bede loves that movie. No.
Lies, all lies.
No, that was one of your horrible picks of last year, I remember.
Imagine Midnight Run. I'm sorry?
Say that again.
It's like, it's not true. I never liked Bounty Hunter. It's not true.
But yeah, I mean, it's basically Midnight Run with, instead of Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro, Jennifer Aniston and Gerard Butler. I mean, do I need to say more?
No.
Oh, also, without jokes, you know, which is a shame, too. It made a little piece of my soul die, essentially. I hated it. And particularly because the couple in front of me, despite the fact that they predicted every single joke 30 seconds before it happened, the same as I did, seemed to love it. And I don't understand that. It's like, you know, making every joke before the film and yet laughing at it, I don't understand. But there we go. And I've got to agree with Marcy on one of her picks. My number one, the worst film of the year, Nightmare on Elm Street. I just thought it was appalling. It was just like watching somebody piss on Wes Craven's grave before he's dead. Yeah, I hated it.
The sad thing is, I was just reading the People's Choice Awards, and it won Best Horror Movie, and I'm just like...
Well, that's because loads of people saw it. The People's Choice Awards have no other significance than loads of people saw this.
It's the dumbest awards ever, and it's like, yeah, everybody's a fucking idiot.
The people who decide the People's Choice Awards are the same sort of people who come into my video store around Halloween time, ask for a scary movie, and I recommend, oh, Evil Dead was really good, or something classic. No, they don't want that. But what do they bring up? The Fourth Kind. These are those kind of people who decide this shit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most people don't like intelligent movies, and that's why things like Nightmare on Elm Street do well, because it removes the nuance, it removes the intellect from the original, yeah, it removes the thematic interest, and instead it's just Freddy Krueger going boom. And that's with some of the worst acting I have ever seen in my life. I mean, I've seen a lot of bad movies. I've seen A Certain Sacrifice, all right? Rooney Mara gives one of the worst performances I have ever seen.
Thank you. She's terrible.
Ugh.
And... Yeah.
Sort of vibrating with anger here, so yeah. You might want to move on.
Another pick,
yes,
please.
Yes, AJ, what are your top three worst films of the year?
All right, top three worst movies of the year. Number three is Furry Vengeance. And I got to say this about kids' movies. We've had a really awful year for kids' movies, especially like live-action kids' movies. A colleague of mine at the OFCS said... But there's a difference between something like Furry Vengeance and something like Marmaduke. Marmaduke was an awful movie, but it kind of went in one ear and out the other. And I kind of liked how in Marmaduke, actors like Lee Pace and Judy Greer and William H. Macy, they were in it, but you could tell they were just kind of doing it for the paycheck. Their hearts weren't totally in it, and they were kind of going, oh no, Marmaduke, you're on the couch again. Oh no. And that kind of made it more bearable to watch when you realize the actors were having as shitty of a time watching it as you were. But Free Vengeance, Brendan Fraser is just so pathetic in this movie because he is bending over backwards trying to make the worst comic scenarios funny. Like, hey guys, I got sprayed with a skunk a couple times. That's funny, isn't it? Oh no, I flew through the air in a porta potty filled with shit. Laugh, please. Laugh. And it's just the worst cartoony, insulting humor. And I just can't believe that any parent would let their kids watch this. Watching this movie, all I could think of was that scene in Billy Madison where, like, the one guy goes, everyone in this room is now dumber for having heard what you just said. Anyone who sees Furry Vengeance is dumber for having seen it. Awful, awful movie. And speaking of really shitty humor, my number two pick is Grown Ups, which is lowest common denominator humor at its worst. Oh, the fat guy fell. Ha ha ha. Rob Schneider's wife is old. Ha ha ha. He got hit in the foot with an arrow. Ha ha ha. There is just no class to it. There is no style, no intelligence or presentation. It's people getting hit, people falling down. That's it. And it's Adam Sandler and his friends pretty much being paid to go on vacation. And there's without any care for actual comedy. It's, well, let's go out to the lake, hang out, and oh, I'll hit my head on a pipe. There. $8, please, American public. And that's my number two pick. And my number one pick is the completely and utterly morally reprehensible The Backup Plan. Featuring,
I know Bede loves
it. Yeah, yes, I know. Featuring Jennifer Lopez as quite possibly an even more evil and diabolical character than Bella Swan. And I'm going to tell you why. This is the sort of movie where she knows that she's pregnant, and she keeps this a secret from Alex McLaughlin, who is a decent enough actor. He was really good as the really fucked up serial killer in Feed. But she keeps the secret from him that she's pregnant, and then he finds out, and he's kind of upset that she didn't tell him immediately when they started going out. But the movie positions it so that he is in the wrong. He is the jackass for saying, well, why didn't you tell me before? And then Jennifer Lopez throws an epic shit fit. And then she, like, just goes through the worst pregnancy comedy scenarios ever. She gets real hungry, so she just, like, slathers her face in gravy and is wiping it off with a slice of bread. Like, 30 minutes into this movie, she completely lost her dignity, any self-respect that she might have gained from being in such awesome movies like Selena or Out of Sight in the Cell, when Jennifer Lopez had promise and she could actually act. All that's gone now. Jennifer Lopez is dead to me. Backup Plan is the worst fucking movie of 2010.
Nicely said. I enjoyed that very much.
Yes. Bravo.
I consider myself very fortunate to have seen none of those.
Yes.
I agree.
Okay, well, I'll talk about my top three worst movies of the year. I'm going to exclude, straight to DVD films, because, you know, they're automatically terrible anyway, so I'll cut those out for the time being. So I'm just going to do theatrically released films.
Mm-hmm.
My number three film is Tooth Fairy. I mean, seriously, that Dwayne Johnson, what the fuck, man?
What the fuck?
It's
like he's had Arnold Schwarzenegger's career in reverse. He's done the shitty family comedies first, and now with Faster, it seems like he's going back to the more action-oriented fare.
And thank God for that.
Yeah.
When I was watching this movie, I felt so sorry for Dwayne Johnson. You know what, fuck it, I'm just going to call him The Rock, because he'll always be The Rock to me.
He's The Rock, just call him The Rock, man.
Yep. But, I mean, seriously, Like, I've seen a lot of action stars doing kids' movies before, and each of them have been, other than Kindergarten Cop, because, you know, that's a classic, but all the rest...
That's not a kids' movie.
Definitely, that's true. But all the rest are, like, really, this movie was, like, I just felt so bad for The Rock. I'm like, dude, why are you dressed up as a Tooth Fairy? Why are you wearing a tutu? Why are you wearing that? Why the fuck is Julie Andrews in this movie? And why the fuck is Billy Crystal in there? And what the fuck is Seth MacFarlane doing in this movie?
I know, right? That is the most random cameo of
people
any
like money.
Film. Seth MacFarlane and Tooth Fairy. What?
I know. I'm thinking to myself, Seth MacFarlane, this is the type of movie you would make fun on Family Guy. Why the fuck are you here? And he's like fifth billed in the movie, and he's like only in the movie for 1 minute. What the fuck? Billy Crystal, again, what the fuck, man? Ashley Judd, what the fuck? Seriously, what the fuck?
What the fuck?
It's a stupid... And also, Stephen Merchant. Seriously. What the hell, man?
At least Stephen Merchant had a good movie out this year.
I have to admit, Stephen Merchant was like the only bright spot in the entire movie. He was like... the movie was about him, then maybe it might have been better, but oh, fuck me.
I didn't see Tooth Fairy, but the one he co-directed with Ricky Gervais, to my massive surprise, is really good. Cemetery Junction.
I agree with that as well, but man, what the fuck? That's all I can say about Tooth Fairy is. Why? It's the kind of... It seems like one of those movies like you'd see like a parody of in like a Hollywood movie, but it's real life, so I don't know, this movie just is terrible. Anyways, my number two worst movie of 2010, When in Rome. Oh man, this movie was so fucking
AJ
annoying. Everyone was just annoying. Like, it has somewhat of a decent cast, but they're all terrible in the movie. And Kristen Bell, I mean, she's a good actress, but I have no idea why she is starring in this crap. It's just utterly terrible. It's not funny. It does, like, the laziest jokes imaginable. Like, it's horrible. That's pretty much all I can say about that movie. It's just... I actually, if someone... who has been to Rome, they really do not utilize Rome at all in that movie, and it's terrible. It's terrible, terrible script, terrible acting, terrible direction, just terrible everything. And it just utterly fails in every regard as a romantic comedy. It, like, makes me angry. This movie was a shit fest, and everybody in it should, like, die a horrible, horrible death. Not the actors, but the characters that they played, so... Yeah.
Okay.
And finally,
Shepard deserves it. Dax Shepard deserves it.
Yes, definitely him. He plays like the most unconvincing male model of all time.
Included Zoolander?
Yeah, but that was intentional. This was not intentional. But anyways, and my number one worst film of 2010 is a movie that, of course, AJ and I have common ground for, and that is, of course, The Backup Plan. Jennifer Lopez, other than Serena and Out of Sight, you're a terrible actress. Stop acting, go away, and never, ever come back. Seriously. You're annoying. Nobody likes you. Go away.
Jennifer Lopez, you're not dead, but I spit on your grave.
And I will say this. This movie has the most terrifying birthing scene of all time.
Oh my god. Oh my
and
god.
It's not actually Jennifer Lopez's character giving birth. It's one of her friends, and it's like it's like the most terrifying thing I'd ever seen all year. More scary than any horror movie.
Yeah, it's like one of those.
Remember, is coming from people who've seen Inside.
Yes.
It's like one of those hippie bullshit new age ceremonies where it's send her your love vibes and they're pounding on drums and oh my god, oh, It's just the worst.
It's horrible. It's absolutely... That's all I can say is... I just want this movie to die a horrible, horrible death. Somebody dig a grave, stick it in the ground, seal it up, and hope that... and pray that it never, ever comes back. That's all I have to say.
It did pretty much tank at the box office, didn't it?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Cool.
So that's...
let's hope.
See, even people have common sense. They see this and like, fuck this movie. I'm not going to go see it. But anyways, enough about our mental anguish from all of us for the time being. Let's go on to happier things now.
Yes.
We are now going to be doing our top five best films of 2010. But before we do that, we might do a rundown of our top five honorable mentions. Movies, we'll talk about this only for a few, like, pretty briefly, and just share, like, you know, common thoughts, what we thought about them, and then we'll move into much deeper discussion when we get to our top five. So,
sounds like a plan.
I'll let Marcy go first. Okay. Because, you know, she's Mistress Marcy, and if I don't let her go first, she'll whip me. Ow!
I just think you like getting whipped, Bede.
Ow!
The dirty stuff starting early, then.
This podcast always eventually goes.
It's dirty. Always dirty. Okay, I've got a honourable mention of Seven, so bear with me. I'll first mention two film-related documentaries that I thought were brilliant, and I don't think it'll come as any surprise that I'm going to say Best Worst Movie and Never Sleep Again. Best Worst Movie being the documentary about Troll 2. And Never Sleep Again being about the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. I mean, they're both very different, but I thought they were brilliant. And I've seen them multiple times. So that's those. Now for five movies. I'm going to go with Toy Story 3.
Because, I've got that on my main list.
So we'll talk about that later. But yeah, loved it. I'm going to say, I'm trying to think of what order. I'm going to say Black Swan, which I know Sam didn't like. what else? I'm going to say Animal Kingdom, which was the Australian crime film.
I have that on my list too, which we'll talk about later.
I only saw that like...
That's got a really good reputation. I think it's coming out here early this year. I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, you definitely have to see that. So what have I said? Okay. I'm lost. I said I had Seven, right?
Yes.
I'm just trying to...
Well, you had Best Worst Movie and Never Sleep Again as the other two.
I'm just thinking... Never Let Me Go... as well.
Yeah, that's a terrific film.
Absolutely loved it. I wanted to put in my top five, but I think I've got like other movies that are in there. And I'm going to go with Blue Valentine as well, which I thought was just an amazing film. Really, really loved
To anyone who liked Blue Valentine, I say see Five Times Two. For me, it's a much, much deeper exploration of a very similar idea. Mm-hmm. It's Francois Ozon's finest film, which is saying a lot.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one. That's a really good movie.
And it strikes me as being very much like Blue Valentine. When I was sitting through Blue Valentine, I thought, well, this would be great if I hadn't already seen Five Times Two.
I'll have to investigate that further, but that's Seven, wasn't it?
I think so. Yes.
Okay. So they're my, Seven. So what did I say? I said Best Worst Movie, Never Sleep Again, Toy Story 3, Never Let Me Go, Black Swan, and Blue Valentine. There we go.
And Animal Kingdom.
Oh, yeah, Animal Kingdom. Didn't I say that?
Yep. Okay. Yep.
Hopefully that's right. Okay. Was that Seven? I don't know.
Yes, that's
move
Seven.
Move along home.
Okay, we'll move on to... Sam, what are your honourable mentions for 2010?
Okay, I'll go alphabetically with this. First off, Armadillo, which is a Danish documentary which I saw at the London Film Festival about some young Danish soldiers going on their tour of duty in Afghanistan. It's incredibly visceral and thrilling, but it's also a really interesting portrait of these, you know, young men going off to war and the people that they are and the experiences that they have. I think it's both a brilliant film and a very, very important one. So that's well worth catching when it opens.
I remember you mentioned that. Sorry?
Sorry?
I said I remember you mentioned it and it sounded really good.
Yeah, it's great. Bluebeard is a film by a French director called Catherine Breillat, who I don't usually like, but I've really warmed up to her with this and her next film, Sleeping Beauty, because she's taking these fairy tales and telling them in a very, very original and very, very arresting way. Bluebeard is the better film, and it is just beautiful. It's this classic fairy tale, but she's rendered it as she's got a young girl telling it to her younger sister. And so you see that both the storytelling and the story that is being told. It's absolutely beautiful. It's wonderfully acted, particularly by Lola Creton in the lead role. And again, well worth checking out. Just a beautiful looking film, if nothing else. Another Danish film, again, one that I saw at LFF, called Nothing's All Bad, which is, if you want to be lazy about it, kind of a Danish Magnolia, only it's sort of more concerned with the sexual connections between people a lot of the time. The outstanding story in it for me is the one of a woman named Anna, who's trying to come to terms with having had cancer and had a breast removed and still sort of see herself as attractive and as sexual. And that's brilliantly played by an actress called Mia Lehfeldt, who I'd never seen before and was completely blown away by. But what's great about it is how it all sort of draws together these four sort of very disparate strands they start as, but it all draws together into this one of the best scenes of the year, this closing scene where everyone sort of comes together in this coincidental way. It's a brilliant film. And I know that's coming out on DVD here this year, so watch out for that. Last couple. I mentioned François Ozon, and his latest film, Le Refuge, is as brilliant as we come to expect. Actually, I think it's probably his best since Five Times Two. It's about a woman who discovers when she wakes up from having had a drug overdose that she's actually pregnant with the child of her boyfriend who died of the same overdose. And she goes away to a house in the country in order to have the child and kick heroin. And we were talking about the, you know, various cliches of the pregnancy movie in when we talked about The Backup Plan. None of them are in this movie. You don't see any of the cliches of the pregnancy movie or the drug movie. It's very much a character piece focused on Isabelle Carré's extraordinary performance. And the whole film came out of the fact that Ozon always wanted to make a film with an actress who was genuinely pregnant. So what you see in this movie is actually a pregnant Isabelle Carré, which adds a lot, I think, to the emotion of her performance. So that... And one final one, again, something from LFF, an Argentinian film called What I Love the Most, which is probably the most divisive film that made my top 10 this year, but I really love it. It's very minimalist, just about two young women holidaying together and kind of their conversations, their experiences. There's an amazing centerpiece, a 13-minute static shot, which is just two people talking on a car, and I found it absolutely riveting. I really just engaged with the characters. I thought it was a wonderful film, and a very atypical one, not something you see very often. So those are my five honourable mentions.
Cool.
Nice.
And AJ, what are your honourable mentions for 2010?
Alrighty, my five honourable mentions. First one up is Kick-Ass, which is definitely one of the most decisive movies of 2010. You either connect with the satire or you think it's way overdone, goes way too far. I thought it was... It is a very intense movie, and I totally get how someone like Roger Ebert would just totally despise it, even though I admired it myself and thought it was a very entertaining, very smart, very dark, but also very funny movie.
If I can cut you off there for a second, it's on my main list, actually, so if we want to get into it a bit more.
All right, Kick-Ass. Next up is Winter's Bone, which could be the start of a new genre, hillbilly noir. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
It's a great choice. It's terrific.
I can't wait for the Australian variation, Bogan Noir. So,
Bogan Noir.
Which I could easily make, since I know a few in real life.
I think we all do.
Winter's Bone, is that on anybody's main list?
No, I haven't seen it yet. But I have seen it. It's a really good movie, and Jennifer Lawrence, great performance.
Yeah, it didn't quite make either of my lists this year, but it's a really terrific film.
Yeah, it's one of those movies. It's a very quiet movie, but it's not one of those movies that just it leaves a lot up to the imagination. It's very quiet about how it does it, but it's not lazy. It's not constructive. It uses its time very well. Well, even though it doesn't make a big brouhaha about like the plot turns or Jennifer Lawrence, her character's quest, it doesn't make a huge big emotional drama out of it. It plays things very quiet, very well done. What's that?
I was going to say, just on Winter's Bone, as much as everyone's kind of gone on about Jennifer Lawrence, and I think she's fantastic in it, it's also worth mentioning the two supporting performances, which I think are amazing, John Hawkes and Dale Dickey.
Oh, absolutely.
I agree.
All right, my next honorable mention is one that I have seen on maybe one other top list of the year, and that's Paul Greengrass's Green Zone. Very underrated movie. It's a very intense movie, and people hate on the Bourne Identity, or the series in general, and for all these other kind of action movies that you. The shaky cam, the jittery cinematography, but here it very much helps, and it helps that there's not really a political agenda behind this, because if you're not aware of the story, Matt Damon's like this guy who's hired to go, it's set during the early days of the Iraq War, and he's hired to go in to look for the weapons, and he's just not finding them, and a lot of his men are dying, and he's just trying to figure out what. And it's a very, very underrated, very intense flick. It captures the right sort of mood. It's very respectful. And it's one of those movies that is entertaining without completely ditching its intelligence. My next honorable mention is a documentary called Tales from the Script.
Oh, you still need to watch that.
Yeah, that's a brilliant choice as well. I love that.
Me too.
Yeah, it's such a simple movie. It pretty much is just all these different writers and directors sharing their experiences in Hollywood, just kind of telling stories about their careers. And I think probably like one of the best stories in there is, I want to say it was one of the very first where Bruce Joel Rubin, who wrote Ghost, talks about like being in the Paramount commissary, and like the executives are telling him like, yeah, Ghost is going to be a hit. You're going to be one of the best writers for us. You got a good career ahead of us. And then like the next week or a month later, he overheard the same executive saying the exact same words to another writer. And like, but that's just one of a lot of great stories that are shared in this movie. And my last honorable mention is probably the best foreign film of the year, and that is Mother, featuring like one of the best female performances, if not the best female performance of the year, from an actress.
Her name's Kim Hae-ja. I believe.
Thank you. I did not want to butcher her name, so thank you very much for saying that. She just gives such a strong, defiant performance as this woman who's sort of... Her son isn't mentally handicapped, but he's just not quite there. He's very slow, and he's accused of this murder, and she just goes to hell and back to figure out, like, what happened and to try and protect him as much as possible. It's a very cool movie, and that is my last honorable mention.
Yeah, I'm quite mixed on Bong Joon-ho, who made Mother, as a director, but I've got to say I loved the central performance in Mother more than I liked the film, but the central performance is incredible. Yeah.
Cool. Okay, before I go into my top five, I just want to make it very quickly, like, I'll just name these movies, because I think these are my honorable mentions, because I think these movies are all pretty terrific, and I loved every single one of them after I saw them. And my little honorable mentions list, of course, is Tales from the Script, which I agree with AJ, great documentary. And probably my favorite scene in the entire movie is when Genevieve Turner talks about how she working with Uwe Boll on Blood Rain.
That's hilarious.
And how pretty much like 80% of pretty much 80% of her script was rewritten, and how she was like laughing in the cinema to say that I didn't write that in the entire movie, and that was pretty funny. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which was actually a movie Sam forget you, man. Which Sam actually recommended me to check out, and I did, and I really, really loved it. And Noonie Rapace, fantastic performance.
I'm afraid I can't recommend the sequels.
Oh well. Anyway, but at least we have the first one. I haven't seen the sequels yet, but I will eventually. But at least we have the first one.
I still need to see the first one.
And she's great, and definitely one of my favorite female performances of the year. Another one actually is Mother and Child, which had Annette Bening and Naomi Watts, which I thought was just this really terrific little drama about these three women, the other one being Kerry Washington, which I found really absorbing. Like, it's not the most original character drama, but I just found it really compelling, and I thought the performances were all great. And Annette Bening, like, even though I really liked her and I thought she was great in The Kids Are Right, but I thought her performance in this one was even better, and it's kind of a shame she's not getting more Oscar buzz about this one. So, yeah, that's a shame about that. Another one is The Ghost Rider by Roman Polanski. Like, again, it's just really great to see an old school thriller, and I just loved every second of it. Like, I knew I was going to like it, but I didn't expect to love it as much as I thought it would be. So that one gets props from me. Also, and this one I actually saw recently, and I'm actually quite surprised I actually liked it. I wouldn't say I liked it, but I really admired it, even though it sort of... And that was Enter the Void, which was a film that stirred up so many different emotions in me. At times I thought it was brilliant. At times I thought it was pretentious. Other times I thought it was compelling. Other times it was boring. You know, I felt so many different emotions while watching this movie. And it's definitely one of the most visually stunning films I have seen this year.
I saw that at LFF 2009, and I was just sort of left with the desire, and which I could have done because he was there, to go up to Gaspar Noé and just say, "Oh, grow up!"
Well, there's a little. I was going in that direction too at times during the movie. Like, it's a movie. I put it on my honorable mentions list because it was one of those movies that was so different from anything I'd seen before. So it kind of gets props from me.
I've got to agree with that.
But I agree. Right. It does. It gets a bit longer the tooth. It could have easily been trimmed by 15 minutes, but. But apparently it is in some countries. But anyways, my next one is Dogtooth, which was...
That's on my main list.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
I think we really need to discuss that movie a bit more, but so we will.
Yep. Also, my next one is I Saw the Devil, which I remember the Arrow of arrowinthehead.com. Absolutely loved, and I check it out, and it's a great sort of South Korean horror thriller that everyone should check out. And I saw the devil.
Yeah, I saw the devil. It was when I was looking at myself in the mirror. Bad joke. Hey, yo.
Would you like a rim shot for that?
But this.
I had to make a bad joke. Sorry.
Okay. Also, my next one is Rabbit Hole, which is kind of a very low key drama about grief, and it just has amazing performances from Nicole Kidman, Aaron Eckhart, and Diane Weiss. And I was actually incredibly moved by this film, and it could have easily been very cheesy and sentimental, but I think with when you have like John Mitchell, is it John Mitchell Cameron or John Cameron Mitchell? Actually, it's John Cameron Mitchell, who did like Short Bus and Hedwig. The Angry Inch, you can expect something that's not going to go in that direction in, you know, terms of sentimentality, and it feels really honest and feels very raw. So that gets props with me. Shutter Island, which I absolutely loved as well. Like, even though as
mentions, do you have, dude?
Yeah. Even though I loved, even though the mystery itself was predictable, but I still found it captivating. But when you watch it again the second time, you realize that it's not really a mystery. It's more of a psychological character study, especially when you keep in mind what happens at the end. So that gets props. Also, Black Swan, which I also saw recently, another sort of really great film. I don't think it's the masterpiece that a lot of people have said, but I did really enjoyed it, and I think it's got a great performance from Natalie Portman and superb direction from Aronofsky. I'm almost there. Also, Never Sleep Again, great doco on the Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you know what the best part about that was, honestly? I'm going to just say it. It was them talking about Freddy's Revenge, and I was just gobsmacked that everybody's going, we don't know what we were doing at the time. And it's like, how can you not know what you were doing at the time? And you hear like Mark Patton going,
watching that movie, it's quite clear that a lot of people didn't know what they were doing.
And Mark Patton's like, oh, it was so obviously gay. And it's like, yes, it's so obviously like, oh my God, I love that movie. And just hearing everyone talk about it was brilliant.
I agree. Loved and it. Also, I kind of geeked out when one of the interviewees mentioned that he thought that Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was like the Top Gun of horror movies. And that's how I always thought about the movie for so long. And hearing somebody else say that really made me giddy with joy. Now, those are my honorable mentions. Now, these are my actual honorable mentions. I know, it's very long. But there's so many great movies.
I thought mine was long.
Okay.
Jesus.
My first one, best worst movie. I mean, it's a movie about the doco about Troll 2, so it's automatically awesome.
There would be something wrong with us if that movie was not like in our top 10.
Of course. My number 9, Heartless, which actually is a film that only just recently made my top 10, and it's a horror movie I absolutely love.
That movie should be in your top 5. And
it might be on more repeated viewings, but at the moment it sits nicely at number 9.
I will discuss it further shortly.
Yes, of course. My next one, so, The Fighter.
I will discuss that film.
Yes, well, so I'm going along. My next one, Kick-Ass, which again, I know we'll talk a bit more. Yes, and finally, Toy Story 3, which again,
we'll talk about.
Toy Story 3. Okay.
Nice.
Anyways, those are my honorable mentions. I mean, like I said, there's so many great movies and I wanted to give a shout out to all of them because everyone should see these movies. Okay, now to our official top 5 movies of the year. I'll head straight over to Marcy with her number 5.
Okay, well, I kind of got my numbers wrong. So I'm going to go with 6. So I'm going to mention Inception, which I thought was awesome. And I think we've discussed it at length on 2 separate podcasts, so I don't really think I need to go into it anymore because I've pretty much said a lot about it. The next one, which I guess I'd put at number 5, would be what Bede just mentioned, Heartless, which is a horror film, British horror film, from Philip Ridley, and it stars the new love of my life, Jim Sturgess. I just completely love this movie. How do I even describe it without just giving anything away?
It's a movie you can't really give away too much about.
It's quite a layered film. There's a lot going on, and it makes you think, and there's just these interesting characters and just all these really strange things going on. It really reminded me of like David Lynch style, which is, you know, a really big reason why it's definitely an attraction. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I thought I would like it. I didn't expect to love it as much as I do, and having it like in my top five for the year. It's just, it's a fantastic film. It really, really is. And if you'd seen Jim Sturgess in his previous films and thought he was crap, well, watch Heartless, yes, and your mind will definitely be changed. Because it's an amazing performance.
Though I've got to say, I've been a little won over to Jim Sturgess recently because I've seen Peter Weir's The Way Back.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
Which is excellent.
Can't wait to see that.
I'm very, very angry with you to see it. Because I want to see that movie.
I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm going to go and see it a second time before I review it. I just want to make sure it was as good as I thought it was.
Mm.
Rub it in, why don't you?
But, I mean, with that one, I'll watch anything that Saoirse Ronan's in, pretty much. So that was kind of why I got to that one quickly.
So, yeah, Heartless.
But I liked Across the Universe.
I liked it too.
Why? Sorry.
I
don't know. It's so weird. We don't have to describe why we love it, man. We just do.
Yeah, I'm pretty tempted to just watch it again.
That's just how we roll, man.
Just to see Sturgess, but anyway, Heartless, highly recommended. Yep. Obviously.
Okay, we'll go on to Sam. What is your number five film of 2010?
All right, I should say these are my top five UK theatrical releases of 2010, so it's a bit different to the top five I've got on my site. Number five, Kick-Ass.
Oh, yeah.
I went into Kick-Ass expecting to be underwhelmed. It was one of these things where I thought, oh, right, well, I'll go in, I'll get a review to the site, and, you know, it probably won't be completely unbearable. And it turned out to be the most fun I have had in the cinema in years. And it's just relentlessly entertaining. And I just fell in love with the screenplay and with the characters. And even with Matthew Vaughn's style as a director, I was kind of lukewarm on his first two films. Layer Cake and Stardust, but I think he's really found his feet as a director here, and made something that's really distinctive and has a particular style to it for the first time. I just thought it was terrific, and you can't let any discussion of Kick-Ass go, obviously, without talking about Chloe Moretz.
She's the best.
Oh, yeah.
She just owned this movie. From the minute she entered with that line, that first line is "Hit Girl," which I probably shouldn't say here.
Don't worry, it's not a family show.
Oh, fair enough. All right, the minute she says, "Okay, you cunts, let's see what you can do now," that was it. Best Supporting Actress was taken care of for the year. And I was completely in love with this movie from that moment on, and with Hit Girl. I just thought it was just the most purely entertaining film of the year. And if you wanted to have fun at the movies, you really couldn't have done any better this year than go and see Kick-Ass. So that's why it made my list.
I agree. Awesome. It's a completely awesome movie, and everyone should definitely check it out. But I have to give a bit of love to Nicolas Cage because he was just absolutely hilarious in that movie. Anytime he did his best, like, Adam West impression, I was pissing myself laughing.
The thing I loved about that choice is that it's not just a funny choice, but it actually makes sense for the character. Yeah, because what I saw in it was a guy who needs to become a superhero, put himself in the persona of somebody he identifies as a superhero. Adam West, Batman.
You know what the funny thing is? Oh, sorry, keep going.
It's just a great character choice too, you know?
What's interesting, though, is that he actually came up with that, his Adam West impression on the set. When he started doing it, Matthew Vaughn And everyone else was like, what the fuck is he doing? We're going to have to, like, reshoot all of our scenes. And, like, and then after a while, Matthew Vaughn sort of looked back on the footage and then he realized, holy shit, he's doing Adam West. And that's when he clicked it and was like, keep doing that throughout the rest of the movie. And it's hilarious. And one of my favorite moments in that movie with Big Daddy is the scene where he and Hit Girl go visit Kick-Ass at his place just after when they pretty much massacred that gang. They go to, and he, I'm trying not to butcher the line, but he pretty much, he's, and the Kick-Ass is like, and Big Daddy is like, you know, don't call, like, just put a message on that, your site that you're on vacation. We will find you. Hurry, girl, back to, I must have fucked it up, but it's a, I fucked it up, so, but it's a funny, like, him, quick Kick Girl, back to base, and he just runs off, and I just pissing myself laughing, but, yeah, I completely ruined that.
Yeah, just a bit.
It's about two steps away from being so over the top that it doesn't work, and it never quite gets there.
I thought it was, anytime a character sort of runs away in a funny why I just piss myself laughing. It just does me wonders. But, yeah.
Okay.
Anyways, enough about people running off in funny ways. AJ, what is your number five film of 2010?
My number five film of 2010 is The Coen Brothers True Grit, which is
that was my
straight
number four.
Up... What's that?
I said, that's my number four, so we can just discuss it now.
Okay, I just want to say, straight up, great genre filmmaking. Yep. Just enough humor, just enough drama, just enough action. Yep. The Coen brothers, I am convinced more and more with every movie, they can do no wrong. They are the men.
I'm just going to plug my ears, because it's not out here till like the end of the month, so la 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 la, I'm not listening.
Oh well, we're not ruining too much, but
it's so great. I don't know what I was really expecting with the film, but I was just so blown away. I loved it, and I thought that the best female performance came from now I can't remember her name.
Hailee Steinfeld.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, she was great. And like, you know, Jeff Bridges, he's Jeff Bridges, like, as if he's going to be bad. And he, like, even, like, with smaller roles, like Barry Pepper, he was fantastic. Just such a great, amazing film.
I did want to comment on this, though. I've heard a lot of people talking about how Hailee Steinfeld is technically the lead in the movie and they shouldn't position her for Best Supporting Actress. Which is very much true, but like Marcy said, it's one of the best female performances of the year, and since that Best Actress category is going to be so dominated, and like all the odds are going to be on Natalie Portman for Black Swan, don't know if she's going to win or not, it's strong inclination, but if making her Best Supporting Actress is what it takes to get this girl an Oscar, do it, because she deserves it. She totally deserves it.
I don't think she's going to win in either category, to be honest.
We'll see. But I've seen True Grit recently, too, and I really liked it. But it's definitely a film that I wasn't blown away by it, but I definitely know it's...
That's
like,
because you
I have to, but well, it's a film I know for a fact that I have to check out again. But, for example, it took me a while to kind of really warm up to Jeff Bridges' performance as Rooster Cogburn, because I only had... Like 2 months ago, I only recently saw the original True Grit with John Wayne, and that sort of still.
Whoa, that would have been.
Oh, now I want to see that movie.
Billy Hess, you son of a bitch.
Sorry. So that, like, John Wayne's still on my brain at the moment, but I did eventually sort of warm up to his performance, but. It's definitely like last year, A Serious Man, which I was kind of the same as well, because I needed time to process it and also give it a rewatch. And when I watched it again a second time, I really, really loved it a lot more. And I think I will with True Grit, but I just sort of, at the moment, I like it. Didn't love it, but I definitely will check it out again pretty soon. Hopefully it will just blow me. It'll blow me away even more the second time around. But that's it. And I have to agree, Hailee Steinfeld, fantastic performance. Okay.
So your number five.
My number five. My number five for 2010 is a film that only just recently put on. That's why I only watched it yesterday, and I actually gave it a 4.5 at the time. But it sort of, after watching it, it sort of lingered with me for a while, and I gave it another rewatch just before we did this podcast, actually, and it just went straight into my top five of the year. And that film is Never Let Me Go.
Love it.
It is.
I liked it a lot. I found it very emotional on a personal level, I've got to say.
I found it quite a moving film. And the thing is, it really doesn't play on the sentimentality. Like, it doesn't, go for the big crying moments, even though there is one in the film. But it doesn't do any of that. It really underplays all of its emotions. And I think that's what really worked for me. But what I really loved about the film, it's a sci-fi film, but it's played very low-key. It doesn't even feel like a sci-fi film at all when you watch it. I mean, I think because it, like, the idea for it is, it's a very ambitious idea, and it's kind of been used before in other films, in like Parts, The Clonus Horror, The Island, and other films and all that. But what makes this film for me different than those other films is that
it's good.
Besides that.
Well, it's about people, not actions.
Yeah, exactly. I was just about to say that. It's really about the characters. Like, it really is really about them. And we especially spend a lot of time... Well, the three central characters of the film, of course, played by Carey Mulligan, Andrew Garfield, and...
That's the other new love of my life, but anyway.
And, and Keira Knightley, who all three were fantastic in the film. And we spend so much time with them. And we get to really know them as characters, and we really see these characters for who they are. But what I loved about the film is that it brings a lot of humanity to this type of story that we have never seen in other films like this before. And I think that's why I really loved it.
Can I just add, at the beginning of the film, when we see them as children, the one that plays the younger Carey Mulligan, I mean, it looks like an actual younger version of her. It's unbelievable.
I agree.
I remember feeling that about the Keira Knightley character as well. The girl who played Keira Knightley
her. It was unbelievable. Like, it just was like, whoa.
But that's my favourite part of the movie, actually, is the school stuff. I thought was absolutely wonderful.
You go first, Sam.
But, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean... I'll keep it relatively vague, but I had a very sort of particular response to it because I've had transplants. I've had two liver transplants. And obviously, when you look at the film sort of through that prism, for me, the moral questions of it became ever more interesting because you got to start thinking about, well, would I engage with a society like this? Blah, blah, blah. You know, if I hadn't, I'd have been... gone, you know, 18 years ago, 19 years ago. It's stuff like that that kind of played around in my mind and made it very rich for me on a moral questioning level as well as just pure cinema.
Mm.
And I agree. And one of the things I've recently read up, like, you know, just on the film beforehand, and some people sort of had complaints, oh, there's not enough of the sci-fi element in there. We're not given much, like, you know, time in the actual world in which these characters live in. But to be honest, one of the reasons why I love the movie is that it doesn't really go into all of that. It really just focuses all its intentions on the characters, and that's what I love so much about the film.
And those people are missing the point. I'm sorry. You know, if you're talking about that with this film, you're completely missing the point, because the point is we're meant to experience it as the characters experience it, so as this great mystery, which, you know, becomes clear and later on. We're meant to experience that with them, not have this omniscient view of the world. It's just trying to get you to live the same experience as them, and you can't do that if you know everything before they do.
I agree. Mm. I absolutely agree. And there are so many other things. One of my favorite scenes in the movie, and Marcy and Sam, you'll agree with me, is the scene where Sally Hawkins talks to the class. I won't say what happens in that scene, but that was definitely one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and it was such a really tragic scene.
I started crying watching that scene. I cried a lot through that movie.
It's interesting. Sally Hawkins has nicked a couple of scenes in movies with Carey Mulligan in them. She did a wonderful one-scene part in An Education as well. And she's just great in this as well. I think she's really impressive as an actress.
Mm.
Yeah. And there's, like, it's beautifully photographed. The cinematography is just good. Like, it's very, I guess the word I could use to describe the tone of the film is mournful. And it comes through the cinematography. But the cinematography is just gorgeous. The direction is sublime. It's beautifully written. And it was written by Alex Garland, who, like, has written other sci-fi films before, like 28 Days Later and Sunshine. So this is very low-key for him, because those are, like, very action-heavy sort of sci-fi movies. And,
but they also have a lot of emotional elements in them.
I agree. And it's such a beautiful film. And just to show, the only sci-fi element in this entire film is that all the characters wear these wristbands, and whenever they sort of enter a building or that, they have to, like, have it scanned. And that's the only type of sci-fi technology in the entire film. And I was really I guess I was just really more impressed on how low-key the sci-fi factor was in the film. And I think that's what made me really love the movie so much.
Yeah, it's coming out here in February, and I would highly recommend that British listeners go and see it. It's a terrific film, so go and see it in February.
Yep.
I agree. Definitely go check it out, everybody. It's an amazing film.
It's an amazing film. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I feel left out. I haven't seen that.
You have to watch it, AJ.
I know. But, I even have a screener of it that I got for the OFCS award season. I never got around to watching it. And it's just sitting here staring at me. I just haven't gotten around to watching it.
Well,
I feel terrible
watch it
now.
Today.
You'll have to watch it right after this podcast.
Yeah.
It is a depressing movie, but it's still.
That's interesting. I didn't find it depressing. I found it sad, but I don't think it's sad.
Oh, well, yeah, I think that's what I was going to say. I think it's more sad than depressing, but I think if you don't really like sad movies, you'll
just cry.
You'll cry a lot in this movie. Or at least tear up. So, yeah, Never Let Me Go, my number five best film of 2010. So, Marcy, what is your... Oh, well, you're already...
Number four was True Grit, and again, it's awesome. Loved
okay, we'll
it.
Move on to Sam.
So, Sam, off
Sam,
you go, buddy.
Your number three.
My number four.
Oh, sorry, number four. It's number four.
I think this may be on another list, or three. But at number four, I've got The Social Network.
Yes, that is still to come on my list.
That's still to come on my list, too.
Well, let's talk about it when we get around to whoever's list it's highest on.
Okay.
But The Social Network's amazing, and we'll go into more detail on it in a bit.
Yep.
I agree.
AJ,
your number four.
All right, my number four pick is another documentary, and it's called Waking Sleeping Beauty. Is this on anybody else's list?
Jealous, want to see it.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
Yeah, Waking Sleeping Beauty, for those of you who don't know about that, this is one of the rare documentaries that just nailed the right period in time. The period in time in which the director decided to focus on it has so many things going on that the drama just creates itself. And if you haven't heard of it, it's posted on a period between about 1984 and 1994 about Disney animation. And it starts when it was kind of in the toilet, you know, The Fox and the Hound had to come out recently and it did okay, but The Black Cauldron was on the way, and a lot of the animators saw that as a huge disappointment because, as they mentioned in the movie, that it got its ass handed to it by the Care Bears movie. And, like, just animation in general didn't seem to be, was kind of like the redheaded stepchild of Walt Disney. But then there was all these different power shifts. Michael Eisner came in and Jeffrey Katzenberg came in. And it focuses on them getting, like, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, getting back to the glory days of Disney animation. And it goes through the successes of Oliver and Company, then Little Mermaid, up through Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, where not only are the movies more successful financially, that like critics and audiences are looking on them as something that aren't just for kids, that are just emotionally fulfilling entertainment no matter what age you are. But at the same time, there's also kind of like there's still the internal power struggles going on. There's the people who want more credit and just want more sway over what happens, just in terms of like how the companies run. And you just couldn't have found a more compelling time in Disney's history to make a great documentary out of. And it's just totally fascinating, to the point that like the way it's set up is that there are no talking heads. It's all done through archival footage, and a lot of it is through home video footage that one of the animators did on the Disney lot in 1980. And just one of the highlights from this scene is you get to see a very young Tim Burton just kind of like at the table drawing away, and just staring at the camera like, kill me now. It kind of like that scene in Alien Resurrection with all the different Ripleys, and one of them asks Ripley to kill her. It's kind of like that. But it's all done through the archival footage and narrating the movie is Don Hahn. He was one of the producers. He did produce Beauty and the Beast, did a lot of the movies back then. And then there's just audio clips from a lot of the people who were there, like Katzenberg and Michael Eisner, and then a lot of the animators and directors who worked on there. And I loved the movie so much that I even watched it with the commentary. So it's talking upon talking. And it just never lost its fascinating edge. It's one of the best documentaries of the year and one of the best movies of the year, period. Waking Sleeping Beauty.
Okay. Awesome. Have you read Disney War? Which is about the whole time that Michael Eisner was in charge over at Disney and sort of the behind-the-scenes wranglings at that time.
I have not. I know that there was a lot of documentaries. Like once this hit DVD in the United States, there was a good deal of Disney documentaries that hit DVD, like Walt and El Grupo. That was kind of centered on when Walt Disney took some animators and his creative team on like the South American tour to kind of promote goodwill. And what they got out of it was like Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros. But no, I haven't read that book. I got to look that up, though. Sounds interesting.
It's well worth reading. It's interesting because it's, you know, one of those behind the scenes business books. You wouldn't think it would be interesting, but it's really, really fascinating and well told. So, yeah, well worth checking out, along with this movie, apparently.
Yeah, looking forward to this one. Sounds really good.
Me too.
It's so awesome. It's so good.
Nice.
Okay. My number four. Now, I know this movie isn't going to be on anyone's list because I know all the ratings you guys gave this movie. And it's actually, the ratings you gave them were quite lower than I gave it, and my number four best film of 2010 is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I really liked it.
Scott Pilgrim made my runners-up list. You know,
well, I mean,
it's a very
in terms
good
of,
movie.
Oh, yeah, I mean, in terms of ratings, like, I gave it a 5, and you all gave it, like, 4 or 3
oh,
out of 4.
This is the same logic where I can give Best Worst Movie 3 out of 4 and really enjoy it. That's not enough for Bede. Oh, no.
Because it should be 5, damn it.
That's a 5-star movie, all right?
I mean, my only problem with Scott Pilgrim is Michael Cera. I get really irritated by Cera. I just think he's always doing the same thing.
I think you need to
hook up
with Nick about Michael Cera discussion.
And he's got very, very little on-screen personality. Other than that, I thought Scott Pilgrim was great.
Well, the thing is, like, I kind of disagree about Michael Cera. I think, without a doubt, this is his best performance. And I think he took, like, the mannerisms that everyone has known, that, you know, everyone knows him for, and he was actually able to project it into a character that was much more than the characters he has played previously. Like, this isn't, like, the nerdy guy who's, that we've all seen in other films, like, you know, Superbad or even on Arrested Development. This is like, well, this guy's more of a slacker. I think this guy's more of the slacker who's really up himself, who thinks, like, you know, he's totally awesome. Like,
Scott Pilgrim was probably the least interesting character in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I kind of disagree, but then again, like, people say, oh, he's just, you know, playing himself, but you could say that about,
I have a boner, you know, for him.
But you can say that about, you know, Woody Allen, Jesse Eisenberg. They pretty much basically kind of play the same kind of characters in every movie. But, you know, but that's just me. But I thought he was great. But what I loved about the film is that it's fucking hilarious.
You loved Mary Elizabeth Winstead and...
to be entirely fair, who doesn't love Mary Elizabeth
Winstead?
And can they please explain why?
Yes.
I've got much love for her, but I know how much love Bede has for her in particular.
Yes. My
Bede's Sorry, head okay. exploded when she was in her undies in the movie.
Dad's right.
I saw an entire cinema of geeks explode when that scene came up, actually.
But, like I said, it's absolutely hilarious. I was pissing myself laughing throughout the entire film. And I think it's because the humor in Scott Pilgrim kind of reflects my own style of sense of humor. So I think that's why I got so much out of it in the comedy department. And it also has some fantastic fight scenes, like some of the most original fights I've seen in the movie in a long time.
Yeah, like you can really tell that Jackie Chan's stunt team worked on it. Yeah, the fights are terrific.
Watch Undisputed 2 and 3 and then come back to me about fight scenes.
Nuh-uh. That's, I'm kidding. But, like, the fight scenes, each one of them is so different and unique. Like, so it's not like, you know, repeating the same, you know, kick here, punch there and all that. Like, every single one is completely different. But also one of the things I love about the film is the cast. Like, every single one in the person in this cast, from the biggest to the smallest role,
Chris Evans,
are all memorable. Like, every single one, like, every character, this, even if they're only on screen for, like, 10 seconds, they absolutely shined. Like, everyone was just fantastic. The vegan police, yes.
The vegan police. But I think my favorite is Brandon Ralph.
Ralph.
I was going to say, Brandon Ralph was like one of my favorites.
The
as
scene
well.
He punches knives in the face is the best scene in the movie. It's just so hilarious.
I thought that Superman Lives was among the most boring films I've ever sat through. But since then, he's really proven to be quite an interesting comedian in a couple of roles. So I'd be intrigued to see what he could do with something where he can play comedy in a lead.
Well, he turned out to be really good on his run on the TV show Chuck. He proved to be quite the awesome, villainy role.
I agree.
I'm a big fan. I think he's great.
I have to, Brandon Ralph, I agree, fantastic in the film. And I always go around, and a friend of mine, we always quote the dust she dusts on Monday bit, like the whole. tell that to the cleaning lady on Monday. Because she dusts.
Yeah.
I also loved Kieran Culkin as Scott Pilgrim's gay's roommate.
I love the scene when they're all in bed and you see, I think, Scott wakes up, then the roommate wakes up, and then there's like two other guys in the bed with them randomly. It's so fun.
I do have to say that as much as I like Mary Elizabeth Winstead, my heart belongs to Anna Kendrick.
Sorry.
Who plays Scott Pilgrim's sister?
She's great.
I bet she was just... I agree. She was really good in the film too, and I think she was just really happy to get away from the Twilight set to do this movie.
And Anna Kendrick is proof positive that there is life after Twilight.
Thank you.
Let this happen to you, Breaking Dawn cast members. Get out as fast as you can.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that
it's entirely fair to Anna Kendrick, she's the one bearable thing about each of the Twilight films.
Because she's only in it for like 2 minutes each.
She's a very
and those
sweet
two
girl.
Minutes, I'm actually interested.
Of course. And of course, she's like the only one of the Twilight cast to get an Oscar nod. Like, well,
ever.
During Twilight, and it probably will never happen again. But, yes.
I said that Kristen Stewart's going to get nominated for something sometime, isn't she? Oh, God.
Well, she is playing like a stripper or prostitute, so you know.
For Lip Biting Horrors Part 2. That was dark. I apologize.
You don't have to. Not on this podcast.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm the guy who thought that Gwildor from Masters of the Universe looked like Harry Knowles, so you don't have to apologize for anything.
Oh my God. That joke ran on for the length of that movie.
There were a lot of disturbing Harry Knowles jokes in that commentary, weren't there?
Well, anyways, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, one of my favourite films of the year, and in my opinion, one of the best and one of the most fun times I had at the cinema this year. So, yeah, awesome movie. Marcy, your number three movie of 2010.
Okay, my number three movie is The Fighter.
Oh, yeah.
Does anyone else have this on their list?
I have it at my number six of my top 10.
Okay.
Haven't seen it yet. Desperate 2 opens in February.
Okay. AJ, no, yes.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. I'll be brief then. I guess I would put it in it's more of like a Raging Bull type, I guess, just with the dynamic that it is about brothers and these harsh relationships, but it's just because, you know, it's true. There's also that element there as well when you're watching it, but it's really probably the absolute best thing that Mark Wahlberg has done, and he's fantastic.
Departed.
Hey?
Departed.
Oh, yes, so Departed too.
Yeah, but I think he's better in there.
I would have said Boogie Nights, but...
I honestly think it's his best role. I'm a really big fan of Mark Wahlberg, which I got into an argument in a previous podcast about.
Come on, guys. Everyone knows that his best performance of all time is The Happening. Come on, let's just all admit it. Get it out in the open. We all know it's
what?
True.
No.
Well, to be fair, anyone who can deliver a monologue to a plant deserves to be paid, certainly.
And knowing afterwards, given that monologue, why am I doing this? Which I thought was funny. But anyways, back to The Fighter.
Anyway, the film has, like, fantastic performances from, you know, everybody. I know that Christian Bale is getting a lot of attention, and deservedly so. I mean, again, he becomes Skeleton, but his character is just, it's a sad character. And, I mean, the film, it is quite... There is like a really sad element, and then things end up changing, and I spent a lot of this movie just crying because there was so much emotional things going on, and I am an emotional person, and it was just certain things that really got to me, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of when I watched The Wrestler for the first time, and I just cried the entire movie without letting up. But it's just a great, great film. I cannot wait to watch it again. Really, really impressive. And there is a fight scene that involves Amy Adams beating a really ugly chick in the face.
Yes. I have to say, Marcy, those sisters, like Mark Wahlberg's sisters in the movie, I swear I wanted to, like, if I were a woman, I would definitely bitch slap every single one of them.
If I was one of those sisters, I would put a hot frying pan to my face. They are just despicable scum of the earth, but they're great performances, perfectly cast, everything.
They're very believable.
It's really
good. But are they more despicable than the sisters in Punch Drunk Love?
Well, I haven't seen Punch Drunk Love in so long, so I can't really say. But I have to agree with Marcy. It's a great film, but I think I wouldn't say it's more like Raging Bull. I'd say it's kind of like a mixture of kind of The Wrestler meets Rocky. And I kind of say that in that way because it's definitely a much more tone-wise, it's a little bit more lighter than The Wrestler. But it's still a very compelling film, and
it's got that battling demons.
It's an underdog
heavily
story
through the film, so
yeah, it's the battling demon slash sort of underdog story, underdog stories always get me. So I'm always like, you know, like go, and then but it's also a crowd pleaser. Like I could definitely see this movie becoming a huge hit because it's got everything that like audiences would love. I mean, it's got great performances and it's like a compelling story, but also it's a very, very much, very much a very enjoyable film. Like,
yeah, I didn't really want to give too much away, but yeah, the fight scenes are great. Yeah,
And also, like, I got to give a shout out, of course, to Christian Bale. Amazing performance. He's definitely going to win.
I'm pretty sure he's going to get an Oscar. Like, I think it's just a done deal.
Like, but also want to shout out Amy Adams. This is like casting her against type because she's like a really tough. Her character's like really tough in the movie, and I didn't like even though she's kind of played like you know, kind of sweet, love like doughy kind of characters before, but this one is like completely different for her, and she's great in the film. And also. Yeah. Melissa Leo, who plays Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale's mum. Oh, she was great too. And she's really pretty much unrecognizable. And she has like the hairdo of 2010.
She's got the hair and the outfit.
It's like pure epicness.
Yeah, it's amazing. But yeah, that's my number three anyway.
And it was my number six. Great film.
It's fantastic.
Go see it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this film got the seal of approval from the guys that it was about, and I think some of the real people were actually in the film, so that definitely says something about what they did with it and how real it was.
Yeah. Sam, you're number three of the year.
Again, I suspect we may be moving on to talk about this in a bit, but because I suspect it's going to be on other people's lists, but Toy Story 3.
That was in my honorable mentions, so...
Mine was in my honorable mentions.
Oh, yes, of course.
So we can talk about it now.
Brilliant. So Toy Story 3 was better than I could have hoped. I don't know about you guys, but for me, the Toy Story series is very special to me. I saw the first one when I was 14, just before it came out, at a preview, and I knew immediately that it was, A, a very, very special film in its own right, and B, going to change everything as far as animation goes. Mm. And I think that's borne out. I mean, I can't think of a single animated film since Toy Story that hasn't in some way been influenced by it. And then the sequel came out and was better. I don't think Toy Story 3 is better than Toy Story 2. But that it's not an embarrassment to the series was almost a surprise. But that it's so good was just a wonderful treat.
I spent a lot of this movie in tears, I gotta say.
Oh, me too. I mean, the last 20 minutes, I was in pieces.
It's so beautiful, and the movie just rings so true, especially now, because, you know, I treasured my toys like anything, and I've still got a lot of them. And now that I've got my little niece, I've started passing the toys down to her, and it's so hard to do.
And this is the thing. This is what struck me. We talked about this on the show where we talked about criticism, but it struck me as so wrong-headed what Armand White said about this, that, you know, because it's using real toys, it's basically a long-form advert. And I just thought, no, you're completely missing the point. It's such an emotional film. And that's what I loved about it so much. I mean, as much as it's very, very funny, as much as the animation is utterly beautiful, as much as the performances are brilliant, what struck me about it is how deeply it struck me emotionally, and how much it's about emotional relationships between people and the stuff that we collect over our lives. And how we connect with that and how we pass that on. I think it's a beautiful film on that level, as well as, you know, just being hilariously funny and just brilliantly entertaining.
I got to say, Ken was awesome.
I love Michael Keaton as Ken. I love Timothy Dalton as Mr. Pricklepants. That's probably my favourite new character.
Yeah, and Lotso, you know, the method hedgehog. Really was a Lotso was a great character as well.
Lotso is a wonderful character.
Cuddly.
I love the backstory of Lotso.
Oh, he looked so cuddly, but then you just when things really started to reveal themselves, he kind of looked a bit less cuddly.
I love
it.
The
was totally
strawberry scented as well. It's just perfect.
I have to say, Lotso, I think, is probably without a doubt, I think, the best villain of the entire series. Like, I don't think I hated a character more of the Freed than him. And he was just really evil. He was totally evil.
But the thing is, the wonderful thing about Pixar is that they provide that backstory and they make you understand why he's like that.
Yeah.
It's not... Actually, I disagree with you, Bede. He's not evil.
He's evil by circumstance.
Misguided, you know.
Yeah,
his backstory is actually quite heartbreaking as well.
That's what's so great about Pixar. Even their toys are truly human. And that's what's so great about Toy Story 3. It's not the fact that the incinerator is a brilliant action scene, though
terrifying.
It is. It's the fact that it hits you on a deeper level than just pure enjoyment. I think, actually, I know it's a big statement.
Ooh.
I think it's the best trilogy of films that we've ever seen.
Well, maybe not the best, but it's definitely up there as one of the best film trilogies.
For me, I can't think of a better one. You know, The Godfather is rather ruined by part three. I know people will argue for Lord of the Rings. It wasn't for me. But I think the Toy Story trilogy is just about perfect. Yeah, it's a wonderful film. And one that kids are going to be watching for years and years.
And, of course, like, the end. The last scene of the entire movie was just...
I hope it's the last film. That's.
I assume it is.
It really needs to be.
I assume it will be. I agree. I assume it is the last one, but from what I hear, they might be doing like little short films that will appear in, you know, other Pixar films down the line. So we won't see the last one, but I think this, as another full length film, this will definitely be the last one, and I think it's the perfect way to end out on.
Yeah, I mean the last scene, I was totally in pieces. But what struck me was, as I was going in, that all of the other punters were like young people, you know, all in sort of their late teens, early 20s. So they've obviously grown up with these movies. And, you know, there's some tough-looking guys there and guys bringing their girlfriends wanting to look cool and things. And by the end, everyone lifting up their 3D glasses and mopping away tears. You know, the hardest bastard in the audience. and that's what this film does to people.
Mm.
Yeah. I agree. It's a wonderful film. Everyone should go see it. And if you don't like Toy Story, you're going to get a slap in the face from all four of us, especially Master.
I think that's warranted.
Okay, AJ, what is your number three film of 2010?
Well, I got to say this first. Toy Story 3, I really liked it, and that's pretty much it.
You heartless bastard.
I liked it. God damn you.
You're a heartless
Foster fucker.
Aha, sucked in. We don't drink Fosters in Australia.
Biggest
misconception
ever. It's a good movie. But if anything, like the parts that got to me the most, that affected me the most, were right at the beginning with the video footage of Andy growing up. Like, if anything, that's what got to me the most. But at the end, not to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't seen it, but when they're holding hands going into fucking Mount Doom, that's gone past emotional, and that's... Okay, guys, you can let up a little bit. It's entering precious territory, where it's just so overtly sad that all I can do is sit back and go, why are you going this far? You don't need to do this. It was still
It's not like they gave any of the toys AIDS. Yeah, which is the moment I sort of parted company with Precious.
Or had Monique throw TVs at them. Yeah, it didn't go that far. But it was a little much. It just kind of tested it a little too much. But it was still an enjoyable movie. Definitely not as good as either of the two. And not even as good as some Pixar movies. Like, I still liked WALL-E and even Ratatouille. I like Ratatouille more than Toy Story 3. There, I said it. But Toy Story 3 is still a really good movie.
You're a heartless bastard. I'm sorry, I just had to get
there. I mean, do you even have a soul?
Yes, do you even have a soul? I mean, AJ watches terrible movies just like me, so technically he doesn't have a soul just like me.
Blah, 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 dingoes and kangaroos. Blah, blah, blah.
All right, now you're number three.
All right, my number three is one that has been discussed on this podcast. That is Never Sleep Again. And it really says something when a four-hour documentary that goes through every movie of the Nightmare on Elm Street series goes through the TV show, brings in just about everybody short of Johnny Depp, and even still they bring in clips of him talking about it. When you can pack all that into 4 hours and you still want more, that is the sign of not only an effective documentary, but a really effective film. It's one of the best documentaries about movies that I've ever seen. So many good stories, so many fascinating discussions about the process of filmmaking, about the cultural impact of Nightmare on Elm Street, and I can't say enough about this. It is such a good movie, even if you're not... Well, I should take that back. It does help if you're into horror and you're into movies, as if you're Joe Schmo moviegoer just kind of popping this in, you will get bored, so it helps to have an inclination towards Freddy and the genre itself. But I started watching this and I was like, okay, I'll go through 20 minutes and then 30 minutes or whatever, and then I'll finish the rest tomorrow. And I stayed up all night. I was just so enraptured by this movie.
It's great. I could add the one thing. The one thing I didn't before, because I was just talking about my favorite part, but the one thing that I was a little bit disappointed with is when they're talking about part 6 and they talk about it as if it's a good movie. It's a fucking horrible movie. Like, they're like praising it. It almost feels that's what they're doing. And it's like, this was the worst movie of the franchise. It's one of the worst movies.
Yeah, especially when they talk about the Peter Jackson, his treatment. That was an awesome idea. That would have been a really good
really
movie.
Good.
And Freddy's Dead is what they did instead.
It's,
really,
it's
you guys?
Shocking, man.
Yeah. That was my disappointment too with it, and the fact that I could have done with a little more set footage and things like that. Certainly, there seemed to be some from Nightmare 3. So it's a bit of a shame that they didn't use more of it. But other than that, I agree with you fundamentally. I think it's a terrific documentary and one that any horror fan really owes it to themselves to see.
And
They should go out and buy it right now.
Yeah, if you watch the extras, a lot of the original people involved with the franchise pretty much say the remake is such a shit idea. So good on them for that.
Yeah, damn right.
I have to agree with AJ. It's an awesome movie, and I actually watched it all in one night as well. So
I've actually watched it a few times because I find it so entertaining.
And it has so many hilarious stories. Like, this, like, listening to the cast of Nightmare 4, like, making fun of Rennie Harlan.
That was brilliant. That guy, oh my god.
That is the other thing, though, what Marcy said about rewatching it. I mean, I couldn't imagine needing to watch it again, ever. You know, it's a great documentary, but I can't imagine when I would want to see it again.
I probably would. Like, I definitely will watch it again at some point. But I wouldn't be surprised even if I just watched segments of it.
Well, yeah, that's it. It's like I might watch segments, or I'll put it on before I go to sleep, and then watch, you know, some more of it the next night. But I have seen it a few times.
And it's great to see some of the cast members now. Like, some of them look good, or, like, you know, Lisa Wilcox,
Melted
and
Face,
Myers.
Monica,
and also and the bad ones like. Monica Keener, who now looks like Howard the Duck.
Oh, that's sad, isn't it? Yeah.
And who was the one that had, like, the silent slave that just...
Oh, yeah.
That was weird. What the fuck is going on here?
Is that like, Salacious Crumb? Is she Jabba now?
The girl from Nightmare 2, I don't remember her name, but she looked fantastic.
I agree. She was a mate. She still
Lisa
looks
character,
great.
Yeah.
Kim Myers. And yeah. I thought it was funny that they also said in the documentary that she looked like a redheaded Meryl Streep, and that's always something I thought of too. And of course, Lisa Wilcox from Number 4 and 5, she looked really good. Really good as well.
Mm.
It's amazing film, and I'm glad it's still number 3.
And Clue Gulager is a fucking
film. Oh my god.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was... He had some funny stories in there.
That was good. Dude.
Yep. My number three of the year, I think I might wait again because I think this is a film that's going to be higher on somebody's list, and my number three, of course, is The Social Network.
Yeah, it's my number two, so we might as well discuss it because I'm next.
And it's my number two as well.
Oh, it was 80. So we might as well just discuss it now, as it was, I think, Sam's fourth?
My number four, yeah.
Yeah. So this movie rocks. Yay!
Oh, yeah, totally. Is this the only film that's on everyone's list, then?
It might be. Possibly.
Possibly, yeah.
It's going to win Best Picture, by the way. And, you know, I'll be less pissed off about that than I am about, you know, most things that win Oscars. I mean, it's not the best film of the year, clearly, but, you know, it is one of them. So that's progress for the Oscars, certainly. I think it's the script.
Yeah.
I don't know about anyone else, but
the script is fantastic. It's so good.
Amazing script.
As soon as I walked out of the theater after seeing The Social Network, I wanted to find the script, enlarge it, imprint it on, like, bed sheets, curl up and take a nap in it. I love this fucking script so much.
I mean, I love Aaron Sorkin's writing. He's clearly, he's a writer who loves words. You know, and I don't believe that about, say, the people who wrote Nightmare on Elm Street, the Nightmare on Elm Street remake. Those people fucking hate words. All right? But Aaron Sorkin just uses them so beautifully. To me, he's like a less foul-mouthed David Mamet. You know, in that he crafts words like that. Hello, anybody?
I'm here. Yeah,
we were just listening to you.
Just there going,
But yeah, I mean, just the characters don't actually talk like real people at all. If you think about the way way that real people talk. And that's what we usually think of as good dialogue, is realistic dialogue. Mm. Sorkin doesn't do that. But what he does is makes this incredibly ornate dialogue sound natural coming out of his characters. And I think that's a very, very particular and interesting skill. Mm. And that's what I really loved about the movie.
Mm.
I agree. The script is amazing. Like, even though The Social Network isn't my number one film of 2010, but if I had to go by scripts, it would definitely be, like, the number one best script of 2010.
I would just love to just sit and read it.
Yeah, it won my screenplay award on my site.
Yeah, it's my, you know, screenplay as well. Not mine,
I would go so far to say a certain movie is my number one pick, and I think we all know where it's going to be heading. But for directing wise, if I had to pick a best director, I would go with David Fincher, because he had like such the difficult task going in of taking what a lot of people just saw from the beginning as the Facebook movie. And at the video store I work at, I've been telling everybody how awesome The Social Network was. And all I hear is, oh, it's just about Facebook. I don't want to see that. And the way I put it is that Social Network is as much about Facebook as A Christmas Story is about a kid who wants a gun for Christmas. It's about so much more than that. It is about the relations between the people. It's about the betrayals and the double crossings and all these different clashing neuroses coming together that Fincher and Sorkin worked together and just captured not only respectably, but entertainingly, like right from that very first scene of Jesse Eisenberg and Rudy Mara just kind of going back and forth. Like, it got me, and few movies can just do that, have me right from the beginning and not let go until the very end. Like, a lot of them have to work for it.
The great thing about the direction on this one is that, for me, Fincher steps back a bit. You know, he's very much an auteur. And you can still tell that this is one of his films, but there's much less, there's a greater freedom, a feeling of freedom to this. There's a lightness of touch about it, which you don't usually get with Fincher's films. I think the most revealing thing he's ever said about directing is that directing is like painting, except you're 50 yards from the picture, holding a paintbrush on a long stick, which is being waved by 50 people, and you're saying, blue. No, darker blue. And I didn't feel that so much with The Social Network. It's got a lightness about it and a freedom about it that really works for the film. And what AJ was saying about the it not being a Facebook movie, that's exactly what I thought this was going to be, a Facebook movie, and it's really not. Facebook is the world in which the film is set. It is not the film. And I was so relieved about that, because I don't understand and am not interested in Facebook. And I don't understand why people are interested in Facebook. But you don't need to be to get something out of this movie. That's kind of the main thing I think to take away.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, and all the performances in this movie are amazing.
Andrew
Jesse
Garfield.
Eisenberg, who knew he had it in it? Like, again,
I saw Roger Dodger.
Oh well, yeah, that's true. And also like the Squid and the Whale, which I thought he was also great in as well, but. But this is like taking it a whole new different level in terms of his performance.
He
and
talks
for me
fast.
Personally, Mark Zuckerberg is like one of the most interesting characters of 2010. I mean, as a character, he's so interesting. And also Andrew Garfield, who was also fantastic.
He was
Andrew Garfield,
amazing.
Terrific. Armie Hammer is the Winklevi.
I'm 6'5", 220 pounds, and there's two of me.
He was fucking fantastic, man.
I mean, Armie Hammer. I really love his name. It's like the greatest name of all time.
He's amazing.
I think the other thing about that performance is that it really shows up. I mean, Marcy and I were talking about the effects in Tron Legacy and sort of the uncanny valley-ness of the Jeff Bridges character in Clue character in that. You don't get any of that with The Social Network, and it was realized in the same way. Okay, they didn't have to de-age Armie Hammer, but there's no sense of this digital double at all, and they did it that same way. It's the effects are, for the first time, completely seamless.
Yeah, I mean, you would think it's two different people.
I had no idea that they'd done that until I read about it.
I know. It's amazing. Like, I knew who Armie Hammer was, so I knew what to expect because I knew there was only one of him playing both roles. But I can imagine somebody going to this movie and it's not even knowing that it's actually one person playing both parts. Like, it's so convincing.
I think it was twins.
Yeah, I think I told this story before. I remember reading a while ago, like, an interview with Armie Hammer, and he talked about that after one of the screenings of the film, this lady came up to him and he said, "Oh, you were really fantastic in the movie, but I have to admit, I thought your brother was a little bit better."
Fantastic.
which was hysterical. And after watching this movie, when I get into the film industry, I'm changing my name to Navy Screwdriver. I mean, it's... I mean,
isn't that more of a gay porn industry name?
Well, Armie Hammer sounds like a gay porn star name too.
Well, but, over here it sounds like a toothpaste. We used to have Arm & Hammer toothpaste.
And also, every time I talk about the movie with Marcy, we kind of geek out about this, is that one of the actors in the movie is Timmy from Jurassic Park.
Yes, I noticed it again how much he's actually in it. Like, he's right there, always in the background as one of, like, his good friends, one of the programmers. And I was just like, oh, my God, it's freaking Timmy from Jurassic Park. He's, like, totally grown up.
The depth of quality of the cast is one of the great things about the film, too. You know, even right down to somebody like Rashida Jones or Rooney Mara is actually very good in it, which gives me a little hope for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Don't tell that to Marcy. She'll get angry.
Oh, don't get me wrong.
I just think she's
really
terrible.
Nervous. But I've got a little hope.
I thought she, like, even though Marcy thought she was bland in this movie too, but I thought, like, even though she's in the movie for only three scenes, I thought she was great in all three.
Yeah, I think she's actually very good in this, and that does demonstrate the idea that perhaps she just needs a really good director.
Or script.
Yeah,
and a really good script.
And plus it helps you.
I stand by my statement, by the way, that her performance in Nightmare on Elm Street is one of the worst I've ever seen.
Agreed.
But it's a surprise that it's the same actress here.
And plus it kind of helps that, you know, they did like 90 takes of that scene.
Well, so, that's David Fincher for you, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have to admit it, I thought this was funny. In the opening scene, even though it's a great scene, I have to admit the dialogue was so fast and rapid, I honestly thought they must have sped up the movie.
Yeah, he talks so
fast. Like,
so
that's like, okay, I'm trying to listen to the dialogue and take everything in, but it's like going at like 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, he
talks
fast the whole movie.
To kick in at any time.
Yeah, he just talks so insanely fast for the whole movie.
Can we also, for a second, talk about how awesome the score is?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Because, yeah. I mean, it's not my favourite score of the year. That's Tron Legacy,
yes.
Clearly. But
yes.
I do love the mix of that piano refrain and the sort of dark electronica that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross used for the score. I think it's really inventive, really of its time. It's a terrific score.
Yeah, it's an awesome score, and it's definitely one of my favorite scores of the year as well. So, yes, The Social Network, amazing film, and I think all four of us can agree with on that.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone should go see it. And if you don't, we'll go on Facebook and annoy you.
Yeah.
I won't.
What was that, AJ?
We'll send you Farmville requests, motherfucker.
Exactly, man.
I have only a vague idea what that means.
Actually, I think they should make a Farmville the movie now.
No, maybe they should
put ideas in people's heads.
Actually, I'll give them even better. I want a Super Marcy.com the movie. Like a super podcast the movie.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
I bagged Meryl Streep playing me.
As long as Rooney Mara isn't playing me, I'll be satisfied.
I'll get Kate Mara to play you.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a better step up.
Okay.
Well, my number two was The Social Network, so Sam for his number two, I'm assuming.
Cool. This one I'm pretty sure won't be on anyone else's list. It's a French film called Lourdes.
I did read about it on your website.
Me too.
Sorry?
I said I did read about it on your website.
And I'm slightly embarrassed about that review, because as much as I clearly liked the film a lot in that review, I didn't really see just how special Lourdes was until the second time I saw it.
That happens.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought it was a terrific film, but it really hit me the second time I saw it that it's really, really special. It's about a young woman played by a brilliant French actress named Sylvie Testud, who goes to... she's wheelchair-bound through MS, and she goes to Lourdes on, you know, one of these trips where they're taking... some nuns are taking a lot of disabled people to Lourdes. And she appears to be miraculously cured. And the whole thing of the film is this question of whether it's a true miracle or whether, you know, the fact that she's fallen for one of the male helpers and the fact that she's in this place where they expect miracles and where it's seen as, you know, something that does happen, whether that gives her the will to get up and walk from her wheelchair. And the film never gives you an answer. And that's really what I think is wonderful about it, that it doesn't dictate these things. When it premiered at Venice in 2009, it actually won two awards. One from a Catholic group and one from a secular group. A critic. And that, for me, is the perfect encapsulation of the film, because it is... It could confirm anyone's thoughts, and it asks these questions without giving you the answers. It allows you to explore these issues. Sylvie Testud is just a spectacular actress, you know, really chameleonic, and the role's a really physically challenging one, and actually, for about half the film, obviously, she's in a wheelchair and paralyzed from the neck down. So there's very little that she has to work with for the first half of the film. And what she manages to express with just, you know, a tilt of the head or a little smile here or there, or, you know, just behind the eyes is, you know, you get so much from her in that performance. And she's got relatively limited dialogue as well. So, you know, it's just a very, very expressive physical performance, despite the physical limitations of the character. It's beautiful to look at. Jessica Hausner, who's Austrian, the director, she worked with Michael Haneke in the early part of her career, and it really shows. She's got a similar sort of very composed, slightly austere style, but a similar eye for both a memorable and a slightly, you know, unexpected image. There's a lovely shot when Christine is sitting just in a church, and what you would usually focus on is Christine in this empty church, but actually two-thirds of the frame is dominated by this massive column, and Christine's sort of shunted off to the side, and it's a much more memorable image for being, you know, different than how anyone else might show it. And there's a lot of that sort of thing in the film. It's I think it's a great film to look at if you're interested in having something to talk about with whoever you're seeing it with afterwards. I showed it to my parents, and my stepfather is, you know, quite religious. He's church warden here. And it was really interesting to talk with my parents about the movie and about, you know, do you think there was a miracle, do you not, after the film? And that's one of the more rewarding things about it. So Lourdes is a brilliant, beautiful film, which everyone should see. And it's one of the very best films of 2010.
Sounds really, really interesting.
I agree. I'll have to check it out at some point too.
Yeah, definitely.
Once it sort of comes available at my end of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear you guys' reactions to that film.
Well, definitely have to try and track it down when. Hopefully, it'll come our way at some stage.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds French. Oh. It's boring. I want the other guys.
You are. The problem.
I want to watch Clash of Titans. I don't want one of them frog movies.
Anyways,
I think we're back to Babe.
Okay, I guess that we're back to me now.
Yeah, because AJ had Social Network as his number two as well. So,
alrighty, my number two of 2010. Is a film, I think AJ can talk to me about this film because I know this would have to be his number one, and that is Inception. I always like to call bomb.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's called Inception.
It's Inception, man.
I'll just put my feet up and shut up.
Yes. You will be quiet during the remainder of this section. That's
you shut your whore mouth, English.
That was dark.
Sorry.
Trust me, that's the least, the kindest things he would ever call anyone. He's called me much worse. Anyways, Inception. I mean, what can I really say about this movie? I mean, I pretty much talked, like Marcy, I talked about it so much in the in our podcast episode when we did our review of it. And I mean, to me, this is one of the best films one of the best films I've seen this year. I mean, I saw it three times in the cinema.
Well, it's got to be the best film you've seen this year, right? It's your number two.
Oh, well, it was the best one until something else came along.
I see.
Yes, so I saw this three times in the cinema, and that,
you're
for me,
crazy,
done
it.
Put off. Because, you know, I'm like it. The cinema I like to go to, you have to pay like $16-17 a ticket. So,
Jesus, Australia.
That's in Australian, mind you. But
so it's like 20 cents American, then.
Pretty much. Yes, but I absolutely love this movie. I mean, I saw it three times in the cinema. I loved it even more every time I watched it. This movie is, I have to give credit to Christopher Nolan. I mean, it's not every day that we have a film like this with so much ambition, with such a huge budget. I mean, usually movies with like $200 million budgets now have to be, like any film that has that kind of budget, has to be like, you know, either a remake of something, or it's like the sequel in a series or something like that. But this is an entirely original film that he has had for so long, that he has had since pretty much he was a teenager. Just the simple idea of this, and he's held it on for so long. And then, you know, all the years of making like films like Memento and the Batman films and The Prestige, there are elements in all those movies that I believe that he was practicing with, that he can hone them all into this movie, because every single element of those movies is in this one. It's just amazing. I absolutely love this movie with a passion. All the performances are great. I mean, it's such an original script. And the score, fantastic. Visual effects, cinematography. And I have to admit, like, I haven't seen, you know, Blue Valentine or any other kind of other love stories that have come out this year, But for me personally, I think the love story, well, between Leonardo DiCaprio and Marion Cotillard's characters, for me, is one of the most heartbreaking love stories I have seen in a movie this year. And I have to admit, the third time I watched this movie, I actually started getting very tearful. Just during, like, especially in the last half of the movie with their scenes together, I was feeling so heartbroken by what was happening. And it's amazing. Like, I don't think, for me personally, Nolan's best masterpiece, for me personally, will be The Dark Knight. But this one is definitely up there as one of his best films. And I absolutely love this movie with a passion. And it's a movie I will watch again and again and again. And I have to
thank... I know what AJ said, but am I allowed to talk?
if you must. Yes, you can.
Look, okay, I'm not a huge Chris Nolan fan anyway, which is basically in the film community at the moment, like standing up and saying, my name's Sam, I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's just not really done, you know, in polite company. But, you know, it is the case. I'm not really a Chris Nolan fan. And I went into this wanting to love it, and I appreciate the fact that it's a $160 million film with ideas. But I just didn't care. I didn't feel anything about the characters. I didn't have any connection to them or any interest in them. And, you know, it's nice that it has ideas, but it spends so long explaining those ideas, and not very satisfactorily. I just kind of stopped giving a shit.
Well, me personally, it's to set up the world in which this film takes place in. I mean,
About 50% of it is raw exposition. I mean, what else does Ellen Page's character exist for except to be some sort of expositional robot? You know, for me anyway, that's kind of how I felt. You know, because every line that she had was either, how does this work? Or, this works in this way. You know.
Well, for me personally, I think she is the audience. Well, she was the audience. Like, she is the audience, like, the audience going into this movie, they want to know this world or how everything works. And she is what the audience is thinking. Of course, like, it's a lot of exposition, but I think personally it works at least well for the movie because at least gives us an idea of this world and, like, what happens within it. And I think that, to me,
I also didn't really feel like I knew anything about any of the other characters. You know, for me, it was emotionless. And I understand how you felt about the love story, and that's great and all. But, yeah, there wasn't a moment in it when I connected to any of the characters for me. You know, they were all just these sort of ciphers that Nolan has set up in this world to get it from, you know, to pieces of a jigsaw. And they're kind of soulless for me. I understand that puts me in a huge, in a tiny minority, but it's, you know, it's how I felt, you know?
I have to disagree because, like, on paper, maybe the characters seem two-dimensional, but I personally believe that the actors brought a lot to these characters. And besides, the movie isn't about them. It is about Leonardo DiCaprio's character, and we get to know, like, all the supporting characters through his interactions with them. And I think, for me personally, that's how I get to know the characters. Kind of,
that's maybe why they're just, you know, Tom Hardy cracks wise a little bit and has guns, you know. But I don't know anything more about him, and I kind of want to, because I'm clearly meant to be invested in what's going on here.
Well,
and
I don't know
more about those guys, I can't really get there.
Well, I could also explain, like, why we probably don't get to, you know, at least get, like, moments of getting to know them as characters, but I'd have to go into major spoilers.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've heard that theory, and that's an interesting theory, and I actually buy it, but it doesn't make me any more engaged in the film. You know, I think there's a real Emperor's New Clothes thing at work with Chris Nolan. I'm just not seeing it, you know?
Well, I think Christopher... Well, for me personally, Nolan really is what make... It, he is the reason for me personally what makes cinema exciting today. Like he's the one of the main reasons why I'm excited to go to the movies. Whenever there's a movie that he creates, I will go there and I will watch it because I know for a fact that I am going to be totally immersed in this world that he's created. And for me personally, Inception is one of those films. But I'm probably saying a little bit too much about it. I'd like to hear what AJ has to say about it. Yes, so that's enough for me. AJ.
Are we going to go over to Mercy? Because Inception's my number one.
Okay, Marcy?
Okay. Sure, okay. My number one movie for 2010 was 127 Hours.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Made my runners-up list.
Yep. So, this choice surprised even me, because I didn't expect that this would be my number one before I saw it. But then I saw it, and I was so engaged in this film, and I just thought it was so well done. It really puts you in the position. Like, if anybody who's listening doesn't know what it's about the guy who he's out one day and he gets stuck in that. What's the best way to say it?
A hole.
He gets stuck in a hole and he falls down like this hole. Basically,
between a rock and a hard place.
Well, yeah, pretty much like
which
a
is
rock.
The end of the original book.
Yeah, that is right. His hand and some of his arm get stuck, because like a rock has pretty much crushed it and he can't move. And there's nobody around at all. He's in the middle of nowhere. Nobody knows where he is, and he's stuck there. And all he's really got is, I think, a little bit of water, I think a tiny bit of food. Not too sure on that part. I think there was a little bit of food. He's got a camera with him, which he records, how things that are going on, what he's feeling. And then he's got this really dull little knife. And he's just in this impossible situation. And the film for me was just about, you know, how much do you really want to live? I mean, you could say that about a Saw movie, but there was a lot behind this because, you know, it's a true story, and this guy actually went through this, and it really got to me. Like I've heard the actual guy talk about the situation, and you know, I cried when I heard about, you know, what he went through, because it's just so, it's very emotional, and it's something that I don't think I would be able to do what he did. I would have been a skeleton in that place if I was stuck there. But he, you know, come day 5, I think it is, 127 hours later, He's there, and he's like, well, I'm either going to die here or I've got to get up and go. And he does something, you know.
I think it's
pretty
fairly
gross.
Common knowledge.
I mean,
I think,
you know,
pretty gross. Pretty gross.
The way to say it, I mean, I think you all know what he does. He has to remove his arm to get out. And it is, all he has is this little dull knife that probably couldn't really cut butter, but somehow he managed to do it. And it is really tough to watch. I can sit through anything. And I mean anything. This had me squirming. It was really difficult to watch.
I remember we talked about this on our
You freaked me out too.
and it's, I mean, I'm a bit of a gorehound myself. And, you know, I can sit through Cannibal Holocaust now. I can sit through Zombie Flesh Eaters without blinking. But, yeah, 127 hours gave me trouble.
It
and there's
was.
One particular moment, I'm sure you'll be thinking of the same frame as I am, which is so excruciatingly painful to watch. You know, there's just... There's one moment where you can almost feel it in your bones.
Yeah.
As he's cutting a particular part.
Yeah. It is just, it's unbelievably engaging, this film. Like, I couldn't look away despite everything. And, you know, the actual guy, I mean, Aaron, how do you pronounce his last name? Ralston? I'm so bad at pronunciation. Like, I just can't say enough things about this guy. Like, it's unbelievable. And the fact is, the guy doesn't have half his arm, yet he is still going on adventures. Like, it's amazing. And I think James Franco definitely gives one of the top performances, like, of the year and of his career. Like, it's fantastic. And I think, you know, Danny Boyle did a great job, and...
What's so impressive about Boyle's direction to me is the way he injects pace and energy into this thing, which is essentially static.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the film primarily does take place with a guy stuck
in a hole.
It's amazingly engaging. It really is. I loved this film so much, and I really can't wait to watch it again. Even though I'm going to be squirming and screaming.
I wish I could take my mum to see it.
Yeah, my mum was really hesitant to watch it, so she kind of, like, kept poking her head in as I was watching it, which I did have a screener for, by the way.
That scene must have really cut... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, no, you go ahead. Do that.
I was going to say, Marcy, when that scene happened, it must have really cut you up inside.
Yes, B. It's your turn to make
again,
a bad joke.
Another rim shot, anybody?
But,
Go, AJ, go.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I was having a discussion a while back with a buddy of mine, and we were talking about kind of Danny Boyle's career, and we all liked, pretty much all of Danny Boyle's movies. Like, for me, Shallow Grave was kind of okay, Lifeless, Ordinary, can go fuck off and die, but, for the most part, like, we really admired Danny Boyle's movies, and we were kind of thinking, well, Slumdog was the one that got the best picture, and 127 hours, I like Slumdog, but 127 hours is so much better than Slumdog. It's a much more risky movie, and that Danny Boyle pulled it off so well is an even greater accomplishment than doing Slumdog, which is a straightforward underdog story. It was a good underdog story, but there wasn't anything in particular special about that. And like Sam said, it is about a guy in a hole. And even knowing Danny Boyle's pedigree going in, I'm like, okay, how is he going to do a guy in a hole for an hour and a half? And like you said, he just gave such energy to those scenes, and he took you inside Aaron Ralston's mind, is kind of running the gamut of emotions, like fear and excitement and anger and sadness, and he just embodied all these things in an hour and a half, and he just took you on that ride. And it's like Franco's performance, and I'm someone who for years did not like James Franco, and I mostly blame the Spider-Man movies, because in those he just wasn't utilized very well. And then in 2006, when he had Annapolis and Flyboys back to back, it was just such a dread. Like, I just did not think that this kid was going to go anywhere. But 127 hours proved me wrong. He did such a great job with a very tough list of things he had to do. And I would probably put this in like my top 15 it is one of the runners up, but 127 Hours is still a much stronger movie than I would have given it credit for when I heard about it originally.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
like
it really snuck up on
me
as well. It was shown on the last day of press screenings at LFF, and it was one of those, oh, I better go. It'll be a good review for the, oh, wow, it's really good.
Yeah, it completely surprised me just like how much I loved this film and the fact that I put it at number one. Like this, it was unexpected. And yeah, I mean, it's just such a great movie. And I really love Danny Boyle. He's such a great director. And I just, you know, everything he does seems to be so different from one to the next, really. And yeah, I mean, I think this really is right at the top for him. So, yeah, that's my number one.
Cool.
Yep.
And I have to check it out because I haven't seen it yet.
Yes, fucking watch it, man.
I will, man. Anyways.
Okay, man, dude.
Sam, your number one of 2010.
The backup.
Well, unfortunately, this probably isn't much of a surprise.
Inception.
Dogtooth.
It's not the Cosbys.
It's Dogtooth.
Yeah, I saw that one coming.
Could there ever have been anything... I mean... I saw it at LFF in 2009, so it actually made my official list in 2009, but it came out here in April last year, and I still haven't seen a better film at all since October 2009 when I saw it. I think Dogtooth is just spectacular. Far and away one of the best films of the past 10 years. It just blew me away. It's this incredibly strange story of a family who are essentially kept indoors by their parents. It's three late teens, early 20s children who have been raised entirely in this house and miseducated by their parents on some really trivial things, and it creates this really strange atmosphere, very much like a Michael Haneke film, some definite shades of real-life cases like the Fritzl case, though it was actually shot before the Fritzl case came to light. It's such a bizarre piece of work, and unlike anything I'd ever seen before, and brilliantly acted by everyone, particularly the kids. I say kids, the young actors playing the children.
The interesting thing about their performances is you could look at it in one way, but when you really realize like what is going on in this film, you just realize how brilliant they all are.
Yeah, totally. You could really mistake them for quite bad performances because they're at times quite robotic and quite rote.
Like, once you
but then
really
you think
know
about how the
on.
Characters have been raised, it makes sense.
Yeah, it's absolutely perfect and brilliant because you don't realize straight away what exactly is going on. But then when you do it, just all clicks.
Yeah, I was blown away by it, and I am every time I watch it. It's such a disturbing piece of work as well. You know, from the way the parents lie to the children. You know, from the tiny lies, the pointless ones, like at the beginning, they're listening to a tape which has a lot of definitions of words, and the mother's voice is on the tape saying, "The sea. The sea is a big, comfy armchair." And zombie is a little yellow flower, and things like that, and these pointless lies. And the lies they tell to keep the world small, you know, the idea that aeroplanes are these tiny things that are hung on the sky and occasionally fall out of the sky. And
that scene
you've got that
just
amazing sequence of the kids fighting over this toy aeroplane.
That that's like that particular thing with the aeroplane really, really got to me. It was just like my jaw dropped. Like, it's just, it's unreal. It really is.
Well, I mean, yes, it is. And yet it's completely believable.
Yeah, the but considering their so situation, it is. Incredibly
built.
Hmm.
That you completely buy that this has happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's in that way that you just, you know, it is shocking and strange, but it's at the same time, it's like, well, that makes sense because of how these kids or, you know, older teens or, you know, young adults have been raised.
And I love the way that it doesn't, you know, sort of seem often to lead anywhere. It doesn't have this... It's not propelled by plot.
Mm.
You know, it's propelled by exploring this reality. And then even when the plot does start to come in towards the end, it's not intrusive. It sort of evolves very naturally. There's nothing...
Mm.
I love the ending. I love the ending so much. The fact that it leaves it on this incredibly disturbing, ambiguous note.
Yep.
I think it's an absolutely astonishing piece of work, and I am breathless with anticipation for Yorgos Lanthimos' next film, which I know is being shot pretty much as we speak.
Oh, okay.
Cool. And I'm really hoping comes to London next year.
Mm.
This year.
This year. Mm. Yeah.
Stunning. So, Dogtooth. If you haven't seen it, make sure you do.
You will never see anything like it, that's for damn sure.
I have to, you know, I have to agree with both you guys. It's definitely one of the most original and most unique films I have seen in a long time. And I definitely, it's definitely a film not for everyone, but I can understand somebody really hating this movie. And to be honest, I wouldn't blame them. But it's definitely, give it a chance, and who knows, you might be find it one of the most interesting films you've seen a long time, and it's a great movie, and I saw it because Marcy and Sam wanted me to, and it was, and it paid off. So it's a great movie.
Yeah, I have been relentlessly pimping this film since October 2009 to anyone who would listen.
Well, let's just hope all our listeners go check it out as well. If you want something different,
I'll get to it. But I have my copy of Lottery Ticket to watch first.
Yeah.
Yep. That's
okay for me.
Yeah. Alrighty. Since I guess you know we already found out what AJ's number one.
I just wanted to. I know we talked at length about Inception and pretty much what Bede said. Yeah, that's pretty much what I have to say. I just wanted to add this, though. Inception is why I like movies so much. I walked out of that theater wishing that I had a time machine and I could go back 10 years ago, like, put Christopher Nolan in a coma so I could write this movie. I wanted to be responsible for something this good because it didn't encapsulates exactly what I look for in movies, or at least like what appeals to me best about movies is that it's something that engages me on an intellectual level. The ideas that it discusses that I just find absolutely fascinating, but at the same time, it is so much fun to watch, and it in it encapsulated both of these ideas just so well. What it had to say about dreams and emotions, it just hooked me. But at the same time, you have these really huge, elaborate action sequences that are pulled off so well. And then you have that score that's just driving the whole time. There's this sense of urgency that you just never get a chance to catch your breath. And there's a difference between movies that are just overkill, like The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is effects right from the beginning, and it just kind of dulled you into submission. But there's a difference between something like that and something like Inception, which just keeps you driving forward because of that urgency in the story, and it isn't just trying to dangle its keys in front of you for 2.5 hours. There's a big difference between those, and Christopher Nolan just found that balance, and I could not, and I haven't seen a better movie since I saw Inception at all. I loved it, but on the other hand, Sam, I totally get what you mean. Like, you admire, you understood it, but you just didn't get it, or you just didn't.
Yeah, I mean, just I think for me, and actually, thanks for saying that about, you know, it's what turns you on about movies, because that for me is an interesting thing, because I think that I have got to a point where I'm kind of looking for different things in movies, you know? And Dogtooth is, for me, what excites me about cinema now. This yeah. completely original, compelling new voice that it's saying something so different and so strange, you know? And that's what excites me. I mean, a lot of what's in Inception I've seen before. I mean, you know, Paprika in particular is, for me, the much better version of what Inception's doing. Satoshi Kon's Paprika.
That's an awesome movie. It was a really good movie.
So, you know, I've been there. I've seen that, and the version that I saw in Inception didn't really engage me. Doesn't mean it's bad, it just didn't engage me. And I don't think Inception is necessarily a bad movie. It's just one that's not for me. I mean, we were talking about this before we started recording, that there are these two varieties of bad movie. One that just sucks, and one that isn't for me. And Inception is that.
Yeah, like what you're saying about Inception is how I felt last year when all the press was going on about Precious. It's like, yeah, oh. I get it. Her life is terrible, and she's struggling with all these different things going on. But it was just sad for the sake of being sad. I just didn't give a shit. Like, that's how I felt about Precious. And I don't think, it doesn't sound like it's that extreme with you in Inception. Like,
well,
you're just like,
I mean, that is kind of how I felt when I was watching. It was just like, yeah, I don't care. And I know what the final shot is. Oh, I'm right. You know?
And that's totally fair. I totally get where you're coming from like that. But like, this, like, how I felt about Inception was how I felt about another very underrated movie, Beowulf, the Robert Zemeckis Beowulf, because that was just so, it was so fun to watch. But then you had all these different ideas going on, like the sins of the father, like, and all those ideas you just didn't expect, or like, I didn't expect out of Beowulf. I was expecting, I didn't know what I was gonna expect, but it was a lot more intellectually and visually enriching than I had anticipated.
Yeah,
and Inception.
Beowulf I haven't seen because I don't like that whole style of filmmaking at all.
Well, you're just stupid.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, I mean, there's that uncanny valley thing that I can't really get past, and maybe that's just me. But you know, I think that's kind of what I'm saying is that maybe you and I, and me and a lot of people, are looking for different things when we go to the cinema. And I think that's perfectly valid because, you know, I know you're on the same page here. I've seen about 8,000 fucking movies. You know, of course I'm looking for something different at this point.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know.
Yeah, and like, I get why you don't like, or why Inception just didn't grab you, but it totally had me, and I love it, love it, love it.
That was
cool.
I agree with on both sides. Like, but I will say this: Precious is awesome, and I don't care what you guys say. But anyways, on to my number one.
Oh,
mine,
me.
Now we haven't gone to
me. Bead.
No, here we go. Oh.
Bead. May a dingo eat your baby.
Oh, well. May Monet come and sleep in your bed in the middle of the night while you're
and
in
it. In the television.
No, that's fucking terrifying.
As you'd be, like, stroking your hair.
the ring with Monique.
I will send a copy of Fat Girls to your house if you don't have.
Bert.
I will send 100 copies of Fat Girls to your house. Anyways, enough about that because it's sort of getting a bit late, so I better get to my number one.
I think I know what it is.
Yep.
I think I've guessed.
For a long time, Inception was my number one movie until I went down to the video shop and I heard about a movie that I heard a lot of good things about and I thought I'll check it out. I rented it. I watched it. And after watching it, I knew for a fact that this, for me, was the number one best film of 2010. And since then, I actually went and bought it out on Blu-ray. And for me, this film is Animal Kingdom.
Yep, I knew it.
Holy crap. I absolutely fucking love this movie. It's just... I just absolutely love it. If anyone doesn't know what the... I'll just give a quick rundown of the story. It's a story about a young guy named Jay, who's played by a newcomer, James Frenchville. And after his mother died of a drug overdose, he goes to live with his mum's family, who just happen to all be criminals. And then after an incident, which I won't spoil, happens, the family decide to... his three uncles, who are all played amazingly by the likes of Ben Mendelsohn, Sullivan Stapleton, and Luke Ford, decide to take revenge on the cops. And then what follows afterwards is pretty much I'm getting a bit tired. It's pretty much like seeing the destruction of this family and just watching it just completely fall apart.
I can say that this is depressing. I was depressed watching this movie. Like, I was very sad, but it's just so well done.
It is.
It's so, like, it's fantastic. And I think I can't remember his name, the writer-director, he just did an unbelievable job.
And David Michon, I think he's...
Something like that.
I can't really pronounce his last name, but this is actually his debut film.
His debut, yeah.
And it's a phenomenal debut. I mean, I don't want to hype it up saying it's like the greatest crime drama of all time, but it has so many great elements in it that just make it stand out.
I think it's definitely one of the best Australian movies to come out for a long time, and I almost dismiss Australian movies because I just don't think that they really just live up to their potential, but I mean, this was something else, and I gotta give a little nod to The Loved Ones for that as well, being just a really great horror movie. So
I agree.
I'm really dying to see Animal Kingdom, but I'm also nervous about seeing it because I've got this horrible feeling that it's going to turn out to be like Un Prophète for me, which was one of these really, really hyped films. Everyone's going on about how great it is. And then I see it and just go, is that it?
To be honest, I think this is a way better than, even though I did like A Prophète, I think this movie was way better for me personally.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where I just hope it lives up to the
hype. Yeah, I was really
scared. This is why I try not to get engaged in hype.
Yeah, I was really worried about the hype ruining this movie for me because I had waited so long to see it. But yeah, this was a really good case where, you know, the hype didn't ruin it, and I really, really, really enjoyed the film.
And for me personally, what I loved about the film, it's kind of like a modern-day Shakespearean tragedy. In a way, because it is. It's pretty much the scene, the destruction of this crime family, and it is depressing, but it's so beautifully well done in so many ways. I mean, all the performances are amazing. Guy Pearce, who plays the cop, like the head policeman who's after this family, he is great.
He's
as
great,
well.
Yeah.
But I have to give a big shout-out to, in my opinion, the best performance in the entire film, which is Jackie Weaver, who plays the grandmother in the family, and she is absolutely amazing.
There is one scene in particular which sold it for me, and I can't really mention what it is, but I think you know what I'm talking about.
And I agree.
It was a scene that was really just, it was crushing in what it was about. It really, really was.
Mm. And she's like, she sort of acts all sweet and lovable around the family, but don't mess with her. That's all I can say. And she's amazing, and I really honestly hope, because she's already got a Golden Globe nomination for a performance, and I really hope that she gets an Oscar nod, because she absolutely deserves it. And in my opinion, she is my favorite supporting actress performance of 2010. I just absolutely love this movie, and I am a big supporter of Aussie films. I will check out any Australian film that comes my way, but Animal Kingdom's like the first Australian film in a long time to actually be my number one of the year it was released. The closest was probably Chopper back in 2000, but that only made my number two. Mm. So yeah, it's definitely, like I said, I don't want to, again, like you say, Sam, hype it up too much, even though I absolutely love the movie so much. But it's definitely one of the best films of the year, and everyone should definitely go out and check it out.
It is definitely making some top 10 lists. It's good to see that at least something from this country is making a bit of an impact.
And if I had to say one negative thing about the movie, and Marcy, I think you're going to be angry with me when I say this, I thought James Frenchville, who played the lead, I thought at times he was a bit wooden. And I don't know whether that was just his performance or whether that was how the character was supposed to be portrayed.
I think it is definitely how the character is meant to be, because sometimes when you go through certain things, sometimes there's no way that you can really, I think, like, with, you know, some people are just that way that you don't show these emotions that are inside. Like, I just thought he was fantastic.
I'm not going to say he's entirely bad. Like I said before, he was wooden at times, but eventually, like, during the course of the movie, he actually gets really more into his performance, and he definitely gets a lot better.
And the ending is unbelievable, and that's all I'll say.
I agree.
I honestly didn't. It was something I never would have guessed. And I usually am pretty good at these things. So, that's Animal Kingdom.
And Animal Kingdom, absolutely fucking awesome movie. And definitely go check it out, Sam and AJ, if you can, once it becomes available. Sorry.
Yeah, I know that here in the States, it's coming out on DVD a week from this coming Tuesday. And I can't wait for it.
It's not the exact release date, but I know it's coming quite soon here as well. Mm. I think it may even be in January.
Yes. And I will say this, if you guys do not like this movie, I will send you virtual punches. I will come after you with a gun.
Will I get virtual bruises?
I send Marcy after you, and she will whip you with her whip.
Yeah, something like that.
What if I want that?
Well, that's a whole other story.
That's a whole other story. Well, I think we can wrap this up for the night.
I think we need to wrap it up. It's quite a long podcast.
But I think it was a really good one. We had some really good discussions about films.
As well as fun
discussion about the worst.
Yeah.
I'll let Marcy have a go, because I know she'll have a lot to say, but I'm glad I hope everyone enjoyed the episode. And definitely go out and check out these movies if you haven't seen them.
I'll just thank our two guests and
thank
myself and Bede for staying up till 4 a.m. in the morning to do this. Thanks to AJ for waking up, and he's been a bit sick, and Sam just is chilling because it's like, middle of the day, early afternoon where he is.
It's like 5 o'clock.
Yeah, well, when we started it was. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much. Hope everybody enjoys the show.
Nice being back.
And same
here.
So catch you later.
Oh, no thanks for me.
Thank you for staying up till 4 in the morning, Bede.
Okay. All right.
Catch you later.
See you, everyone.
See you.
Word.